people in here. We have a new person in here anyway. Anarchist. Oh, man, I don't know if I like that, Nick. But anyway, Anarchist, welcome to the room. I haven't seen you in here before. Shabbat shalom to you. Anybody else in here that's new? Not that I can see. I believe Cat in the Hat. Yeah, Cat in the Hat's been here before, and so has, there was one other that I saw, Bible Says. I remember greeting you last week, so welcome you all to the room. Thanks for showing up. We're here today to study Yehovah's Word. We're going to be looking at Genesis chapter 21, 1 Samuel 2, verses 21 to 28. We don't have a psalm again this week. And then we're going to look at Matthew chapter 1 and verses 18 to 25. We're going to spend most of our time in Matthew more than likely today. I've got some stuff that I prepared specifically for this study, and I'm also going to share stuff from you, from my work in progress called The Life of Messiah Yeshua, a Messianic Perspective. And so that's what we got planned for today anyway. And then Rip has all kinds of stuff planned for after we're done with the Bible study, so hang around. He spent a lot of time putting it all together for you, and I hope that you hang around and take part. It's he gets some good stuff for us that has something to do with the study that we just did. Okay, so it carries on into the afternoon. Also, after everything that he's gathered together, he's also going to play TTRT from this past Tuesday. Which I can't even remember what the parsha was. My goodness, it wasn't Chukat. That was the one after that. Anyway, we're going to go ahead and get started. We have a number of prayer requests today. They're pretty much the same ones we had last week, only there are a few different details that I'm going to be able to share with you. At least I'm hoping that that's why they shared them with me, so that I can share them with you. And we'll pray for them as well. Anyway, we begin every week with the Shema. The Shema is the central truth of Scripture. That's the way I see it anyway. If you can understand, if you can ever understand that Yehovah is one, that he's not three in one, he's not ten in one, he's not 450,000 billion gazillion in one, he's one. He's the only intrinsic existence, the only thing that exists in and of himself. Everything else that exists that you can see and hear and feel and touch is all real, except that it wouldn't be if he weren't speaking it into existence at this moment, using the same power by which he created everything that there is. He holds everything together with exactly the same word. That's according to Colossians chapter 1 and verses 16 and 17. So it's spelled out plainly right there. So he holds everything together by the word of his power. And so we bless you, Father, for that you're doing all that so that we can experience you. And that's what we're here to do. So the Shema goes like this. It goes, Shema Yisrael, Yehovah Eloheinu, Yehovah Echad, Baruch Shem Kavod, Malchuto Leolam Vayed. Hear, O Israel, Yehovah our Elohim, Yehovah is one. Blessed be the name of him whose glorious kingdom is forever and ever. Amen v'amen. Father, thank you for bringing us all here together today. We're here to study your word, and we ask that you would put your spirit on everybody that comes in this room with the idea of learning of you and of helping us to learn of you. That's what we're here for, Father, and we bless you that you give us this opportunity. There are a number of spirits that don't work for you that are probably looking around us trying to figure out exactly what it is that we're learning and the truth that we're going to learn today. And so, Father, we're going to ask that you would take those spirits and blind their eyes, deafen their ears, take the feeling away from their fingers or whatever it is that they've got, any way that they're able to perceive anything, and just confuse it, make it worthless to them as far as the truth that's going to go out here today. Take that truth that goes out today from whatever source it comes and file it away in our brains so that we'll have access to it when we need it, because the time comes very shortly here that we're not going to be able to have a Bible under our hands or under our arms. We're not going to be able to access the written word, and we're going to have it in our memories, Father. Bless those memories towards your truth. File it away in our brains in a systematic way so that when we have a need for it, we can access it immediately by the power of your Spirit. We bless you for that, Father, in Yeshua's name. Now we have a number of prayer requests as well, Father. First of all, praise for Jim and Kat and all of the good things that are coming to them. Jim is, I don't know, he hasn't told me if he's got his glasses yet, but he said they're on the way. He'll be able to see in a binocular fashion. This will be wonderful. He'll actually have good depth perception again. And that's, I'm sure he's looking forward to that. Also, Kat has had a thyroid tumor that she, not tumor, but a lesion on her thyroid that was biopsied, and it came back clean last week. Okay, week before last, and we praised you for that last week. Now she is leaving tomorrow to go out to Vimar in Vimar, California, which is between Reno and Sacramento. And she's going up into the mountains, and she's going to get the same lifestyle training that my daughter got for the last 2.5 weeks or 3 weeks. And bless you, Father, for that. My daughter is doing wonderfully well. I bless you so much for what you've done for her through Vimar Institute. We've now found another place that has bariatric oxygen for cancer patients. And they have the bariatric oxygen out there in Vimar too, but this, they use it specifically for diabetics. And my daughter wasn't able to get involved with that. But this one that we found is in Loveland, Colorado, only a 2.5 hour drive from her home. And the possibility is that we're going to be able to do that, Father. We may have to pay for it as we go, but we're going to do it. And Father, and we're going to bless you for the finances because I don't know where they're going to come from. but I know you're going to provide it. And now, also, Kat is going out there to do the New Start lifestyle training. And Father, just enrich her mind and body by what she's going to learn over the next 2.5 weeks. Bless you, Father, for the ability to find places like this that are going to attack our physical ailments by prescribing your prescription, which is good, wholesome food, exercise, the sunshine that we need to develop a lot of different vitamins in our own bodies, Father. I bless you that you did all this stuff and that you've given us that knowledge. And now you're going to give Kat specifically the knowledge that she's going to need to make herself even more healthy than she is now. Her cancer is in remission, but we're hoping that you're going to get it completely taken away through this New Start program. We bless you, Father. And we bless you for the people that have been through it and have testified to its efficacy as well, including Dr. Lorraine Day and others that I've talked to. Bless you, Father, for all of them. Now, let's see. Our brother Daryl and Tabitha have run out of food. Okay, they're just out, and they're starting to hunger. And so, Father, we're going to ask that you would provide all of their needs by whatever means necessary. I'm asking that all the people there are going to pray for them, but I'm going to give you this caveat, folks, okay? Do not pray for something that you're not willing to be the answer to, okay? Yehovah will, if you pray for someone, Yehovah will lay them on your heart, okay? He will keep them in front of you, and he will expect that you're going to do something, not just by prayer, but by actually providing. And the provision can be a dollar, okay? It can be whatever you're able to do. He's going to make you want to do it. And if he makes you want to do it, don't you eschew that, okay? Don't you turn your back on that. If he lays it on your heart to provide something, you provide it. Bless you, Father, because he's going to bless you beyond your ability to understand by adding a little blessing to your brother. Okay? It's not that we give to get, but that he is faithful to produce 100 times. Not in the same way necessarily, but 100 times what you provided. He will do it. He's promised it to us. Okay? So, you pray for Daryl and Tabitha. You pray for my daughter Hannah. You pray for Kat and Jim. You pray for all the people that God lays on you to pray for. And you be willing to be the source of a physical blessing to them as well. Or a financial blessing to them as well. Or whatever. Okay? However he lays it on your heart to do, you do. If he does that, if he gives you that burden and you provide, he will provide for you. He's told you, I'm going to give you 100 times more. Okay, so, and again, it may be in a completely different venue. But he will provide a bigger blessing than you provide. Okay, bless you, Father, for that knowledge that you've given us through your word. And we bless you for it in Yeshua's name. So my daughter is looking forward to this this bariatric oxygen treatment, as well as the same kind of fever treatment that she was getting out at BMAR. This is a wonderful opportunity, Father, and I bless you that you've put it before us, and I'm asking that you would provide the need, provide what it is that we need, which is to the bucks to pay him. I can see a little bit of it, but I can't see all of it. And so I'm blessing you. I'm asking you, Father, for the provision. And I know that you're going to provide. And I bless you for the provision right now in advance in Yeshua's name. And that'll be that. We'll go to the scripture. Okay. Genesis chapter 21. Verses 1 to 34. And Yehovah visited Sarah, and he said, and Yehovah did as he said, and Sarah did unto Sarah as he had spoken. Okay, now there are people who think that Sarah was already pregnant when she went to when Abraham and she went to Abimelech, which we saw last week. Okay, the fact is that this is the point. It was after all of that that Yehovah, I think that he's giving this to us in chronological order. Okay, they went to see Abimelech. As they're leaving there, that's when verse 1 happens here. And Yehovah visited Sarah as he had said, and Yehovah did unto Sarah as he had spoken, for Sarah conceived, and bare Abraham a son in his old age, at the set time of which Elohim had spoken to him. And Abraham called the name of his son that was born unto him, whom Sarah bare to him, Yitzhak. And Abraham circumcised his son Yitzhak, being, I'm sorry, where did I got lost? Oh, there it is. Being 8 days old, as Elohim had commanded him. And Sarah was 100 years old when his son Yitzhak was born unto him. And Sarah said, Elohim hath made me to laugh, so that all that hear will laugh with me. And she said, who would have said unto Abraham that Sarah should have given children suck? For I have borne a son in his old age. And the child grew and was weaned. And Abraham made a great feast the day that Yitzhak was weaned. And Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, which she had borne unto Abraham, mocking. Hagar, the Egyptian, was mocking. Wherefore, she said unto Abraham, cast out this bondwoman and her son, for the son of this bondwoman shall not be heir with my son, with Yitzhak. And the thing was very grievous to Abraham's sight because of his son, talking about Ishmael. And Elohim said unto Abraham, let it not be grievous in thy sight because of the lad, and because of thy bondwoman, and all that Sarah hath said unto thee, hearken unto her voice, for in Yitzhak shall thy seed be called. and also of the son of the bondwoman will I make a nation, because he is thy seed. And Abraham rose up early in the morning, and took bread and a bottle of water, and gave it unto Hagar, and the child, and sent her away, and she departed, and wandered in the wilderness of Beersheba. And the water was spent in the bottle, and she cast the child under one of the shrubs. And she said, she went, rather, and sat her down over against him a good way off, as it were a bow shot. For she said, let me not see the death of the child. And she sat over against, and lift up her voice, and wept. And Elohim heard the voice of the lad, and the angel of Elohim called to Hagar out of the heaven, and said unto her, what aileth thee, Hagar? Fear not, for Elohim hath heard the voice of the lad where he is. Arise, lift up the lad, and hold him in thine hand, for I will make him a great nation. And Elohim opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water. It's Beersheba. There's a well there. Okay, and she went and filled the bottle with water and gave the lad drink. And Elohim said, was with the lad, and he grew, and dwelt in the wilderness, and became an archer. And he dwelt in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother took him a wife out of the land of Egypt. And it came to pass at that time that Abimelech and Phicol, the chief captain, And it came to pass at that time that Abimelech and Phicol, the chief captain of his host, spake unto Abraham, saying, Elohim, with thee in all that thou doest. Now therefore, swear unto me here by Elohim, that thou wilt not deal falsely with me, nor with my son, nor with my son's son, according to the kindness that I have done unto thee, thou shalt do unto me, and to the land wherein thou hast sojourned. And Abraham said, I swear. And Abraham reproved Abimelech because of a well of water, which Abimelech's servants had violently taken away. And Abimelech said, I wot not who hath done this thing, neither didst thou tell me, neither yet heard I, but today. And Abraham took sheep and oxen, and gave them unto Abimelech, and both of them made a covenant. And Abraham set 7 ewe lambs of the flock by themselves. And Abimelech said unto Abraham, what these 7 ewe lambs which thou hast set by themselves? And he said, for these 7 ewe lambs shalt thou take of my hand, that they may be a witness unto me, that I have digged this well. Wherefore he called the place Beersheba, because there they swear both of them. Thus they made a covenant at Beersheba. Then Abimelech rose up, and Phicol the chief captain of his host, and they returned into the land of the Philistines. And planted a grove in Beersheba, and called there on the name of Yehovah and the everlasting Elohim. And Abraham sojourned in the Philistines' land many days. Okay, that's the whole chapter. And now, there are, in this book, in this chapter, or in this Bible study, rather, today, there are going to be 3 miraculous births. We've already read about the first one, Yitzhak. Okay? 3 miraculous births. In our Haftarah portion, 1 Samuel chapter 2, we're going to see Shemuel's miraculous birth. And then in Matthew chapter 1, we're going to see Yeshua's miraculous birth. And so we're all looking forward to that. There will be a number of I thinks today, and in all of them, I could be wrong, but I seriously doubt it. Now, Genesis chapter 21, verse 1-8. Yehovah follows through on his promise to Abraham. 25 years ago, he had promised Abraham that his seed would be as the stars of the heaven and as the sand of the sea. Now, at age 99 and 89 respectively, Abraham and Sarah conceived a son, whose name would be Yitzhak. When Abraham knew that Sarah was with child, he knew that Yehovah could and would do all that he'd promised, and he got off the spiritual roller coaster. His faith never once again wavered. Yitzhak was born on the same appointed time that Yehovah and the two men visited a year before. If you remember, what Abraham prepared for them to eat, it included cakes of bread, cheese, and a fatted calf, a cheeseburger. The cakes were not loaves, and so were unleavened. The Mo'ad was Pesach, 14th day of the first month. I'm not saying that it was necessarily on Pesach, the 14th day of the first month, or even the 15th day, on the day of the first day of Matzah. What I'm saying is it was in that time frame, sometime in during that week, I believe, between the 14th and the 21st. When Yitzhak was circumcised, he became the very first person ever circumcised on the eighth day, as Yehovah had commanded. Now, think about this for a minute. If he was born on the 14th, and on the eighth day he was circumcised on the 21st, and all of it happened between Pesach and the last day of unleavened bread. Okay, so I think that he was probably born on Passover, the day of that the Passover lamb would have been offered. And he was circumcised on the seventh day of unleavened bread. Okay, so that's my own personal, the way that I tie the knots together. I could be wrong, but it's an I think. One of those I thinks that I talked about. When Yitzhak was circumcised, he became the very first person ever circumcised on the eighth day as Yehovah had commanded. At least the only first one that we know about. Abraham had presided over the circumcision of Ishmael and the servants and himself, but they had all been done well after the eighth day. Yitzhak's circumcision day was the 21st of the first month and the last day of the future Feast of Unleavened Bread. That's my own personal opinion, which could be wrong. The rabbis say that Yitzhak was conceived on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, which would put his birth sometime around Sukkot. Okay, this doesn't fit the narrative's context, I don't think. Now, Sarah was laughing again for good reason, as she thought, who'd have thought I, a 90-year-old woman, would give Abraham a son in his old age? It's a mikamoka, okay, a who is like thee, for she is referring to the prophecy given to her in chapter 18 when Yehovah told this to Abraham in her hearing. Only Yehovah, the ex nihilo creator, could have prophesied this to happen and it occur. She doesn't have any lapse for faith from now on either. And I'm open to questions and comments up to verse 8. Chapter 21, verses 1 to 8. I'm open to questions and comments. Anybody got a question or comment, raise your hand. I'll be happy to give you the mic. And let me see. I got to change my settings here a little bit. While I'm doing this, y'all can raise your hands. Ah, Truth and Ken, your hand is up. You may go ahead and have the mic. Take it away.
Okay, Shabbat Shalom, everyone. Thank you, Daryl. I noticed off the bat here in verse 1, it says that Yahuwah visited Sarah as he had said. Funny thing is, he didn't use the word visited, the word pakad. He said to Sarah he would return, which is the word shub. But I do want to say this. So, of course, I have to put those two words together then to say, well, when Yah says that he will return, he's saying he will visit. And this word visit, the word visited is the word pakad, which is to charge, okay, to bestow upon. Another very interesting usage of this word that we're all so familiar with, and we have in our minds what we think it means, because it's usually translated as the word numbered, is in, for example, Shemot or Exodus chapter 30. When the children of Yisrael were supposedly numbered. For example, Shemot 30 verse 13. And they shall give everyone that passeth among them that are numbered. That's the word pakad, numbered. a half a shekel after the shekel of the sanctuary. Verse 14, everyone that passeth among them that are numbered from 20 years old and above, they give an offering unto Yahuwah. And I made a comment, and I made notes on this particular word in Shemot chapter 30, about the numbering. And what I said was in verse 12, thou shalt take the sum of the children after their number, and shall give every man a ransom for his soul. This word number, pakad, I mentioned that pakad actually means charged, committed, or even enjoined. Thus, it makes more sense that this verse, this is Shemot 30, verse 12, by the way, it makes more sense that this verse is showing us that the tribal chiefs were charged as such. Meaning, you know, they were given this great commitment or enjoining with Yah, something that he is proclaiming unto them, you know, that they are then committed to do or committed with him. You know, being charged is like being one with the one charging unto you, that you will do something as the one who's charging has said to do. And this then better explains the following verses 13 and 14 and the concept of passing by. You know, when they leaders passed by. So I just wanted to make this connection, because too often than not we take unto our hearts, and this is how we sort of render things, is the way that the King James, which is usually the version that most other versions adopt, you know, that's the version that many will take the English word and you know, share it with us here, such as this, that Yahuwah visited Sarah as he had said. Did he commit to Sarah? He certainly did. Did he enjoin unto her? He certainly did. So, you know, again, the same concept that I explain in... hold on a second. Hold on a second. Let's see if I can mute that. Okay. Yeah, that was loud, huh? I'm getting jumped on by some wacko here. Sorry about that. Yeah, monkeys in the room. Exactly, Sandy. Oh, there it is again. Yeah, some guy named Carl. Sorry about that. Anyway, I just muted that. Hopefully you guys can still hear me. Can y'all still hear me? Okay. So anyway, I just wanted to comment to say that, you know, too often than not, we just, you know, take a word for as it's rendered, and we don't, you know, dig in deep for ourselves. So I just wanted to show you how the tribal chiefs being so-called numbered, which I really don't per se say that I agree with that translation. I really like the word committed or charged, actually. Charged is even a better word, that they were charged by Yah. And I feel like even in this case that Sarah is being charged. She's being enjoined in a way by Yah, okay? And that he is doing a great work through her. That's the issue here, is it not? It's that he is doing a great work unto her, or through her, that he would not normally do with anyone else. You know, here she and Abraham are in this old age. And so Yah is doing something great and wonderful that people of that age would not be able to do. So truly, this is a charging. It's not just, oh, he came by and said hi, you know. I don't see it that way. I see that Yah had literally charged her to have a son, You know? And she did. I mean, that's... I'm breaking up again? Oh, sorry. Okay. Well, if I'm breaking up, let me cut this short here. So just like Mark said that Isaac or Yitzhak was the first to be circumcised on the eighth day, it truly means too that Abraham was the first father to circumcise his son on the eighth day. So we should see both of these things, you know, Abraham being the first and Yitzhak. But by the way, if you look at the Hebrew, that word Yitzhak should really be Yitzhakak. Yitzhakak. That's interesting. Anyway, let's see. Abraham was 100 years old. By the way, I've tied this in with, and I can't remember where it's at, and maybe I should hold on one second. I remember the words, some 50, some 100. Does anyone remember these words? Some 50, some 100, and some 20, or some 100, some 50. I can't remember how it goes. Or 60, I'm sorry. 100, 60, and something. 30? Is that it under my feet? Okay, do y'all remember where that is? Hold on a second. Ah, here it is. Matthew 13, verse 23. He that receiveth seed into the good ground, which, you know, consider this, seed into the good ground, can also be likened unto a son being brought forth unto a father, the good ground being the father, and understandeth, which also beareth fruit, and beareth forth some hundredfold, some 60, some 30. Actually, that hundredfold is, the word is actually 100. Some 100, some 60, and some 30. Now, one thing that I do know for sure is that Abraham was 100 when he bore his seed. Yitzhak was 60 when he bore his seed. These two numbers I know for sure. I believe that it was probably Jacob that had a child at 30. I don't know which one. But I believe this verse had to do with the seed, because it is about the seed, is it not? But he that receiveth seed unto the good ground is he that heareth the word. Okay? Abraham heareth the word. He hears Messiah. Right? Yes. He hears, and it says some 100, some 60, some 30. Well, that could be when the seed is produced. You know, I always sort of have put that together years ago. I really think that's what was being said there. Anyway, so just for consideration to all, this may be what that verse is truly speaking of in Matthew 13, verse 23. Okay, and that ties back to this verse, Bereshit 21, verse 5, where Abraham is 100 years old when Yitzhak is born unto him. And, you know, this word laugh, too, you know, that Sarah laughed, it truly must be a very enlightening laugh. Not just a funny laugh, not just even a mocking laugh, certainly not a mocking laugh, but a joy that it just goes beyond joy. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. I mean, this is how we all should be, and yeah, we should all have a Yitzhak among us, you know? We should all have a good laugh. Because I really think that's the issue here. Now, verse 7 and 8. this is something interesting that I've really brings to my attention. The fact that there was a certain age in which it says here that Yitzhak was weaned. The word for weaned is gamal, okay? To benefit, to requit, to ripen. I believe it may even be something along the lines of to know right from wrong, okay? Now, I know it's not until a man is 20, until a male is 20, that until he's told that he's a man, okay? But apparently that's not when you're weaned. Weaned, I believe, has more to do with maybe even sucking, okay? Sucking on the milk. Because here it says in verse 7, okay, that Sarah is giving suck to the child. And then it's immediately going on to say that the child then grew and was weaned. Yes, weaned could be to where he no longer sucks, as in sucking on the milk, right? Maybe he's ready now to eat the meat, spiritually speaking. You know how we, we can actually use examples of this in Scripture, where, you know, when one's first learning, he's sucking, and when he's ready for the the bigger understandings, he starts to chew on the meat, you know? Okay? And of course, you don't want to give meat unto babes. You want to give milk for sucking. You want the babes to suck, not to chew on meat, okay? they're certainly not ready for the meat. So this weave is most likely a point in one's life when he's beginning to know right from wrong. And now he can literally start to learn the deeper meanings that, in these cases, in this day, was Abraham's duty as a father, okay, to teach the weightier matters, you know, the meatier matters. It was up to the wife to raise a child up to a certain age, which apparently has to do with what's called weaning, where she's giving suck unto a child. But then the child gets to a point where he needs to chew on the meat. Now, maybe this is where the Jews have gotten this concept of when a boy becomes, so what they say, becomes a man, but they know that's not exactly true anyway. They would probably agree that, yes, Scripture says the age of 20, one becomes a man. But they believe that, I guess, a boy knows right from wrong around the age of, I think it's something like 12 or 13. So maybe this is where this concept comes from. This particular, these verses here, 7 and 8, where no longer does a child suck. Okay? Maybe he's now weaned. And there's a feast given to him. Same thing the Jews do, right? So maybe this is what we're talking about here. Could it be that Yitzhak was maybe 12 or 13? Because if that's true, then keep in mind how much older is his brother? The one who we are about to read is mocking. I mean, that Mark will share with us. So keep this in mind, okay? What's his name? I forgot his name already. The Egyptian woman's son, the son of the bond woman. Hold on. Ishmael. Thank you, Mark. Boy, I just had one of those aging moments, apparently. yes, Ishmael. that when he's mocking, he's no little boy, okay? Matter of fact, he is probably past the 20-year-old man age, I believe. Because I believe he was born how old was Abraham? Was he like 85? Something like that? So in this case, he was probably about 15 or so when Yitzhak was born. 86, thanks, Flamount. Okay, 86, so it's 14. So let's say now that Yitzhak is weaned, let's say he's 13, that would make Ishmael 27. he's certainly of man's age, and he certainly should have no problems being out on his own, which we just read is what he was told to do, to go out on his own, right? Just like Yah said unto Cain, remember? He said unto Cain, you will now leave. And of course, you know, Cain was like, oh, but that's too great of a burden. But still, he was a man. He was able to go out on his own and live, you know? So, you know, we shouldn't think of Ishmael as some little teeny boy that his mother Hagar is like holding in her hands, because that is certainly not the case. You know what I'm saying? Okay. Anyway, that's only up to verse 8, so I am going to yield the mic.
Thank you, Ken. Thank you for all of that. Ishmael was probably 30. Well, he was 13 when he was circumcised. And that was a year ago at this point, a little bit over a year ago. And so the probability is he's about 14 years old. And you're right, he's not a little babe in arms, okay? And he was one of the ones that was doing the mocking, I believe. And so, you know, I thoroughly understand Sarah's reasoning behind demanding that they be sent away. And I also understand Abraham not wanting to let his son that he's had in his, you know, that he's raised from a baby to 14 years old now, you know, to send him away. You know, this is his son. He loves his son. He doesn't want to send his son away, but Elohim tells him, Sarah's right. Sarah's right. You do what... And in this particular case, I think it may be just to keep peace in the household. Because if he had let that kid and Hagar stay there, it would have been a source of nothing but domestic trouble from that moment until they were gone. So it was a wise thing to do, I think. Anyway, are there any other questions or comments on verses 1 through 8? Any other questions or comments? Verses 1 to 8. If there are no questions or comments, we shall move on to verses 9 through 21. Okay. Questions or comments going once? Going twice? Moving on. Here we go. When Ishmael laughingly mocked Yitzhak, Sarah saw the intent of in his visage and demanded that he and his mother be put out of the camp. Now, let's look at that real quick, like, because I don't remember reading Yitzhak this morning as I was reading through there. Let's see. And Sarah saw the son of Hagar the Egyptian, which she had borne unto Abraham, mocking. There you go. So it was Ishmael that was doing the mocking, not Hagar. Okay, so when Ishmael laughingly mocked Yitzhak, Sarah saw the intent in his visage and demanded that he and his mother be put out of the camp. In chapter 16, when Hagar despised Sarai, Abraham took a kind of ho-hum attitude to Sarai's complaint. Remember in 16, verses 5 and 6, it says, And Sarai said unto Abram, My wrong be upon thee. I have given my maid into thy bosom, and when she saw that she had conceived, I was despised in her eyes. Jehovah judge between me and thee. And Abraham said unto Sarai, Behold, thy maid is in thy hand. Do to her as it pleaseth thee. And when Sarai dealt hardly with her, she fled from her face. Okay? So it's in that chapter, Hagar was Sarai's handmaid. In this chapter, we read that she is Abraham's handmaid. Just if you remember what we read just a few minutes ago, that's the truth. Here we go. Back to my notes. But this demand from Hagar, or from Sarah, rather, deals with his beloved son. Abraham is understandably upset with this demand because he loves his son. But Elohim told him to not be upset, for in Yitzhak would Avraham's seed be called. Elohim said to Shema, Sarah's word, and send Hagar and Ishmael away. Notice that there is no hesitation on Avi's part. He packs his bags, packs their bags, places them on their shoulders, and sends them off, knowing that Elohim would do as he said, make Ishmael a nation. Okay? He promised, I'll make this boy a nation, a great nation. He will be a great nation as well. Okay, Hagar starts from home, but wanders. The Hebrew word there is ta'ah, and it means vacillate. Hagar can't seem to decide if she should go home to Paro's house or back to ask forgiveness of Sarah again. Well, she vacillated long enough to use up all of the water, and she despaired of their lives to the point that she put Ishmael under a tree and went far enough away that she couldn't see or hear him as he died. And there she wept. I don't think she was weeping for Ishmael so much as her own plight. She didn't call out to Elohim to help them. She left that to Ishmael to do. Jehovah heard Ishmael's cries. That's what it tells us here. Let's see. I got to find that particular. And the son of the bondwoman will I make a nation because, okay? And Elohim heard the voice of the lad in verse 17. Okay? So he heard Ishmael's cry. Okay, now I lost my place in my notes. Okay, here it is. Jehovah heard Ishmael's cries and told Hagar to go and take care of him. When she obeyed his voice, he opened her eyes to the well that was there. Beersheba is where it was at. And she filled the bottles and revived Ishmael with the water. It was the water, not the food, that ran out. Avraham had given them plenty of both to get them to Egypt had they gone directly there. A thought occurred to me. It may be, that Hagar returned to her father's house, that either she or Ishmael had a child there, and that some 200 years later, a descendant of that child ascended to the throne of Paro, and was a Paro who knew not Yosef, the very one who, just to be vindictive, put Abraham's seed under bondage. Now that, of course, is just a thought that occurred to me as I was running through here. And so that's one of those that is, it could be wrong, but I doubt it. Okay, so the wilderness of Paran was in the northern area of the Sinai Peninsula between Wadi al-Arish and the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba. Hagar made arrangement for an Egyptian wife for Ishmael, and he settled down to father the present-day rulers of that land, Hamas. It is a principle of Scripture that whenever we try to help Yehovah with his revealed plans, we end up causing trouble for our offspring. So if we are patient and wait for his timing to obey without question, everything works out perfectly. Okay? Let me read that again. But if we are patient and wait for his timing, or obey without question, everything works out perfectly. If Sarah had not suggested that Abraham go in to Hagar, there would have been no Ishmael, or the trouble that his offspring have caused, and I think that Sarah would have conceived at that time. And I have no proof of that, but it fits Jehovah's character and his word, at least as I understand it. We truly do reap what we sow. When we try to get ahead of him, we cause trouble. If we wait on him, or we do exactly like he tells us, he blesses us. Okay, and I'm open to questions and comments up to verse 21. Are there any questions or comments on Genesis 21, 1 to 21? Raise your hand, I'll be happy to give up the mic. Anybody else new in here? Truth and Ken, your hand is up, you may take the mic. Take it away.
Well, I just wanted to comment on this word mocking. Verse 9. It says that Yishmael was mocking. And this word mocking is the word Yitzchak. Or Tzakak. Right? Tzakak. Which means to laugh. And this is the same exact word, tzakak, as we see in verse 6, where Sarai says, Elohim hath made me to laugh, tzakak, and so all that hear will laugh with me, tzakak, will laugh with me. And interestingly enough, we have Yishmael laughing. But, as we know in Hebrew, there can be a good side to a word and a bad side to a word. This happens to be the bad side, most definitely. And to give an example of the bad side is, if you remember the story of Yosef being in the house of Potiphar, and the wife of Potiphar, who tried to throw herself physically and sexually upon Yosef, and because she was so hurt that Yosef did not give himself unto her, she then lied and told everyone that Yosef, or that that Yosef had mocked her. Okay, in Bereishit 39, for example, verse 14, she says, "See, he hath brought in a Hebrew," meaning her husband, "hath brought in a Hebrew unto us to mock us." That's that word, tzakak. "He came in unto me to lie with me, and I cried with a loud voice." So, of course, she's lying here. But anyway, here's that word, mock. And that's a negative connotation. So, yeah, this is one of those, you know, instances where a word, I mean, even just three verses later, at one point it means to laugh. And another point, the same word means to mock, and we see the difference. Now, the big deal here is that Sarah has a say in this relationship. You know, and it's something that I don't know if we all realize, and this is truly how it should be in one's house. You know, that the wife, who is of Yah, has a say in matters. Okay, it's not like she's just some little obedient housekeeper who makes the dinner. You know, makes the dinner and serves the drink and whatever for her husband, whatever he wants. No, you know, when she says something, that husband better love her enough to understand and to hear and to sometimes even obey, you know, to love her enough to do what she desires. And in this case, Elohim was confirming for Abraham that she is correct in what she's doing. And what is she doing? That's what we should really concentrate on here. She is causing separation, right? She is shunning one part of the family, telling them to disperse, to leave the house, you know? Which is what Yah does, really, in the concept of divorcement. Okay? He divorces one who is not of the right seed, right? That's not acting correctly. He divorces. He sends them away, out of the camp, out of the house. And here is what Sarah is saying. I want this one out of the camp, or out of the house. And of course, Abraham is sickened by this, because this is really a wife unto him, right? Or concubine or something along those lines. But also, this is his firstborn son unto him. So, of course, he's bothered by it. And we're all bothered by such division in the camp, are we not? It's always somewhat of a breaking of the heart, you know, when you must separate. But you know what? Yah tells us, be separate and be perfect as I am perfect. He should have said, be separate as I am separate. But he doesn't put it that way because he knows that we won't always be separate with him, with that there will come a day when all living creatures and people and everything that lives will be one with him and not separate. But, again, this is what Seta is saying here. She wants this part of the family to live separately, okay? Not to inherit with her son. It's not good for her son. Okay? So, even though he is now not of the age to suck, that he should know right from wrong, that he's being weaned, right? Even though he's weaned, she's apparently showing him a weightier or meatier matter. She's showing her son a meatier matter, you know? And she is literally telling Abraham, her husband, to send away the other son. And we should take this as a righteous act, okay? We shouldn't see this as division. Funny thing happened in my own camp here in my home years ago when I had a nice little assembly going on here, and it was a time when people wanted to divide. They wanted to go and start their own ministry at their own home. And I some people thought of that as such a negative thing, and me, I was thinking that's such a positive thing. You know? Good, then you go somewhere else and you spread the word over there, you know. So to me, it was a good thing, and maybe that's one way that Yah, you know, gets the word out throughout history. Actually, we can see this, you know, that he sends forth his children, just like when he divorced the northern 10 tribes, he sent them out of the house. But we know that they will return, you know. We know that. So anyway, I just wanted to make sure we're aware of this. This separation that Sarah is demanding, and Elohim is actually approving unto Abraham. Okay? And then they are sent away, and like I mentioned, I really don't think he's exactly a babe. Okay? It keeps saying the child, Yeled, but all I can think of is, well, he must have been a bit of a immature guy. Maybe not, you know, chewing on the meat so well yet. Maybe he wanted to continue sucking. Maybe he had a hard time being weaned. I don't know. But, you know, I think that when we read the words, take him in your hand. I'm trying to remember where that was. I remember seeing it. And maybe some people think, oh, yeah, put the little babe in your hand and walk off. Well, I'm sorry, but she's not about to put this man in her hand. Believe me. this mama was a babe. Okay, I get it. Now, let's not go down that path, Mark. But anyway, yeah, I think maybe that just means take him by the hand. Because he's a big boy. I'm sure he was much bigger than her, as a matter of fact. and so take her take him and go. You know, put his hand in yours and go. Because, you know, as I think I mentioned last week about the hand, that has a lot of significance when you take one by the hand. You know? And I think this is what Yah is trying to share with Hagar. So, anyway, also keep in mind, one of Shaul's writings in the book of Galatians, it might be chapter 3. You should probably read that while you got these words fresh on your mind, you know, about the allegory that Shaul or Paul gives about between Sarah and Hagar. It's probably a good time to look at that and, you know, better understand what's being said there. So, anyway, that's all that I have. I yield the mic.
Thank you, Ken. Thanks very much. Appreciate all of that. Good observations. Are there any other questions or comments on the Torah portion up to verse 21? Disciple Nazarene, your hand is up. You may have the mic. Take it away.
Shalom. This is a mic test for the entire group. Maybe there's some irony in the story, because Sarah treat, and so Hagar's the Egyptian, and obviously Sarah gives birth to Yitzhak. But then we get to the story of the Exodus, and the Egyptians treat the children of Israel harshly. So maybe there's a twist in the story, that because Sarah treated Hagar the Egyptian harshly, when it comes to the Exodus, the children of Israel were then treated harshly also. Just a thought. So with that, mic is free. Shalom.
That's a good observation, brother. I mean, that's a possibility. And then, you know, there could be a genetic memory. I truly believe that Hagar, or rather that Ishmael and his wife, are the progenitors of the Pharaoh of the Exodus. And so that's a very good possibility. It may be a genetic memory. It may be something that was passed on from Ishmael through his seed, if you will, down to the Paro there. That's a possibility. that's a good possibility. I kind of like that idea. Are there any other questions or comments? Any other questions or comments? Adam, your hand is up. You may have the mic. Take it away.
Well, thank you. I just came into my observation that Ishmael and the Ishmaelites, it turned out to be down the ages a big problem for Israel. So oftentimes, I don't think we pay much attention to the problem that Abraham caused to his grandchildren and great-grandchildren with those kind of descendants from Ishmael. What do you think?
I just wanted to build on what Naz was saying there, because Ken had brought up how part of his wife laughed at Yosef, too, and mocked Yosef. So, because Yosef was already enslaved in Egypt and being treated harshly, and then later his brothers would, well, at least the descendants of his brothers would suffer a similar fate. But then it is interesting, though, that later when they come out, they do loot the Egyptians as on their way out, and they seem to be like encouraged to leave, obviously, but encouraged even with gifts. So maybe it's bribes to get them to get out. I don't know.
Thank you, Adam and Tom. Adam, I'm sorry I was distracted by something and I didn't hear your observation. All I heard was, what do you think? So, is it possible that you could reiterate? perfectly okay. All right, Adam 149. Okay, here you go. Take the mic.
Yes, I was listening to Ken. The observation came to the, if I remember correctly, some of the descendants of Ishmael, they had trouble with Israel, and I guess some of them could have been close to the Israelites in the land, but overall I believe they've been a problem for Israel. Am I correct, or am I missing something? So there was a problem with Abraham, their forefather, because if they would have never taken place going into Hagar, the Ishmaelites would have never been. I'm done.
Yes, we're actually going to see that in a couple of weeks. think I was looking at September, the second week in September, I think we're going to be looking at exactly that. I can't remember exactly now, because I was reading something yesterday, going over my notes, you know, my previous notes, to either add to or subtract or whatever, you know, to bring it up to date. Anyway, I think that there's something in there. It will be on September 13th, I think, that we're gonna see something like that. Anyway, I have no doubt that Ishmael's sons are pretty much everywhere. Very shortly, I have no doubt that Hagar took him an Egyptian wife. I think I read that in the Torah, in the scripture today, that he took him an Egyptian wife. And I believe that those kids became, at least one line of them became the pharaohs. Hagar, I believe, was a daughter of the pharaoh. Okay, Abraham and Sarai went down to Egypt. She was given Hagar as a handmaid, and I believe that was his daughter. And I think that's what the scripture actually tells us. So it's really interesting that she goes down to Egypt and gets a daughter of a pharaoh, I think, for a wife for her son. That's a part of it. Now, he had more than one wife, and we'll see that as we get to his genealogy in a couple of weeks. But, you know, he has other Canaanite wives as well. And then Esau has three or four wives, most of them Canaanites, but there may be one Egyptian there too. So, you know, this is a constant struggle with within the Abrahamic line. We got Ishmael and Yitzhak, and they're at constant odds, okay, and they still are. And we have Esav and Yaakov, and they're constantly at odds. And so, we'll see the root of all of that as we go through the next 4 or 5 weeks of Torah portions. So, watch for it. There's a very good possibility that the Pharaoh that didn't remember Yosef was the son of Hagar and son of Ishmael, way down the line. Anyway, Truth and Ken, your hand is back up. Go ahead and take the mic.
Yeah, just for further clarification, we should note that in verse 10, Sarah is showing her wisdom here. She says, this bondwoman, the son of this bondwoman, meaning Ishmael, shall not be heir with my son, Yitzhak. Should not be heir, which is the word yerash, to inherit. Because she knows of the covenant that Yah gave unto Abraham, you know, that this son would be the seed. Okay? She understands it. and it reminds me of what Ribka did when Yitzhak's eyes were dim, you know, and he favored Esau, remember? So what did Ribka do? She actually, fooled Yitzhak by having Yaakov, you know, put, hairy hands and all this stuff. But it's because of these women's wisdom, okay? They had wisdom. And this is a great example of how Sarah knew what was going on here and what had to be done. That Yitzhak was to be the inheritor, not Ishmael. And so she said, it's now time for this separation. And she is absolutely right. That's what Yah is telling Abraham. You know? So the inheritance, when it comes to the inheritance, there must be division, because Yah has promised this inheritance to a certain seed. Okay? And we are to separate that seed from any other seed. And we see this in Scripture in everything he talks about. Separating, not mixing the seed. You know? And she is so right. She is just absolutely right. It's no wonder he changed her name. You know? She was a righteous woman. And she thought righteous thoughts. And that's all there is to it. I mean, you know, Abraham, maybe he didn't realize what a wonderful woman he was married to, full of wisdom. But she truly was doing what was right. Not just in her eyes, but apparently in Yah's eyes, because she understood the covenant that Yah gave to her husband Abraham and regarding the seed, you know? So, anyway, I just wanted to throw that in for maybe additional clarification. So, I yield the mic.
Thank you, Ken. Thank you. Very good. Also, if you have the patience, little wings, you can go to my Facebook page, Fulfilling Torah Ministries, and if you go to the, it's either under notes or under pages, I'm not sure, I think it's under notes, there's a whole bunch of those Bible studies on a weekly basis, and they began in 2013, in March of 2013, okay? Beginning in Genesis chapter 1 and verse 1, and we run right through Deuteronomy chapter 34. It takes 3 years to get through. We take it usually one, maybe two chapters of Torah per week. Okay? And this week it's chapter 21 of Genesis. And we started this one in, I believe it was in March of this year, 2016. Okay. Any other questions? Sarah's daughter, your hand is up. You may take the mic. Take it away.
While I was listening, it occurred to me about the honor versus shame aspect. Sarah understood that Hagar, or Ishmael, was shaming. I confess to forgetting who mocked whom. But it was about shaming. And you can't have that. You know? Anyways, I just thought I'd throw that in there, about the honor and shame. Been learning about that, little by little. Next on the mic, or Mark, your mic.
Thank you, Sarah's daughter. Yes, you're absolutely correct. Ishmael mocked Yitzhak. And I don't know why. Maybe it was shortly, right after his circumcision. Hang on a second. Let me run back up there and have a look at that. Okay. Called the name of his son Yitzhak. 100 years old. God made me to laugh. Who would have said that? Okay. And the child grew. Okay. And Sarah saw the son of Hagar the Egyptian, which she had borne unto Abraham, mocking. And that was after he was weaned, so that's not what I was thinking. I was thinking that he might have been mocking the kid crying because of his circumcision on the eighth day. But that's not the issue. It was 3 years later when he was weaned. Usually weaning happens when sometime around the third year. Other questions or comments? On the Torah portion up to verse 21 rather. Questions or comments going once? Going twice? That is where we get our Torah portions, by the way. It's at messianic.ws. And they've got a triennial cycle. And it starts usually in March, might start as late as April, but it's usually begins in March. It usually begins on the first Shabbat following the Aviv new moon. Okay? So, okay. No other questions or comments. We're moving on. Verses 22 to 34. Well, I've already read the scripture, so I'm just going to go right directly to the notes. So Abimelech came to negotiate the deal with Abraham, and he brought his chief general, Phicol, with him, perhaps as a bodyguard or perhaps as a knuckle-dragger for intimidation. Abraham was not impressed, as we'll see in a bit. Phicol means mouth of all, or perhaps all mouth. He never said a word at this meeting. I think he'd been putting ideas into Abimelech's head, false ideas about Abraham. All Abimelech wanted was assurance that Abraham had no plans to usurp his throne or that of his offspring. I think, these I thinks, by the way, are all italicized, so I could be wrong. I think Phicol was the source of the rumor. Abraham gave Abimelech his assurance that he had no designs on the throne of Philistia. I think also that Phicol had designs on the throne and wanted to cause doubt in the mind of Abimelech against Abraham, because Phicol knew the story of the nine kings and that this was the guy who wiped them out. He may have wanted Abraham out of the way for when he attempted a coup d'etat versus Abimelech. But Abimelech remembered that Abraham could have had the throne just last year, when his entire nation was experiencing general constipation of every excretory orifice, and that Abraham had petitioned Jehovah for the curse to be lifted. Abimelech knew Abraham's character, and so he went to Abraham to ease his mind, and if I am correct in my thinking, to shut Phicol up. Then Abraham got to in Abimelech's, but I think the point was being made to Phicol, face about his men stealing a well that Abi's men had dug. Abimelech was surprised to hear this from Abraham, and I think truly had never heard of it before, as he stated. So Abraham gave back most of the animals that Abimelech had gifted him with only 9 to 10 months before to pay the prophet's fee for prayer and a good report, and separated 7 ewes for Abimelech to notice and to ask about. Abi told him that these were a surety that he had dug the well and possibly purchased the land in which it was dug from Abimelech. I have no proof of this, but I think that Abimelech had no better producing ewes in all his flocks than these 7 as a reminder of the covenant with Abraham. Here's what was likely going on backstage that Abimelech never knew or heard of. This now, again, likely. This is in italics, so it could be wrong. All right. Now, I'm exposing an educated guess on my part here. Phicol was having his men wait until Abraham's men dug a producing well, and then would swoop down and steal it. Abraham, being a visitor and sojourner on another man's land, bided his time, waiting for the proper opportunity to make his case, and just had his men dig a new well. Since Abraham didn't do anything, Phicol took courage and started planting ideas in Abimelech's head about Abraham, the purpose being to get Abimelech's permission to go in and wipe Abraham out and steal his servants and property. Abimelech knew Abraham's character and didn't believe it, but after hearing the same Lashon Hara often enough, one begins to consider it is true. Abimelech was a righteous man in human terms, and he decided to go to the source and settle the issue. This is the proper way to go, by the way. When you have an issue with somebody, you go to the source. Okay? You don't go talking to other people about it. You go to the source. You got a problem with this guy, you go to this guy. You don't go to anybody else, you go to that guy, and you try to figure out what's going on. I have heard this. What do you have to say? Okay? That's how you do that. Okay. When he heard of the whale issue, he started to see the truth was more than just what was passing Thykol's lying lips. He was truly all mouth and of low character. The same two Philistines pulled the same shenanigans on Yitzhak some 40 years later, or maybe their kids. Chapter 24, we're going to see that in chapter 24. And that's what I was reading this past week. Okay? And it came to my mind. Thykol, having turned Avimelech's character to one more like his own, or perhaps it was the son of the Avimelech in this encounter. Give it a few weeks. We'll be talking about that 3 weeks from now. Chapter 24. And that's all that I've got on the Torah portion. Any other questions or comments on the Torah portion? I'll be happy. Truth and Ken has his hand up, and he may have the mic. Take it away, bro.
I just wanted to confirm anyway. and let me find the verse that Abimelech is asking for a covenant. Here it is, verse 23. He wants Abraham to swear Shabbat. Okay, remember that happened. That has to do with sevening oneself, Shabbat. Like Shabbat. So he wants Abraham to seven himself, that he will not deal falsely. You know, that word falsely, you only see six occurrences of this word shakar in the Hebrew. Only six occurrences, but one of which we should definitely note, because this is a commandment unto all of us, is in Vayikra, or Leviticus 19, verse 11. Ye shall not steal, neither deal falsely, neither lie one to another. Oh, spell it. Shaka, S-H-A-Q-A-H, or A-R, I'm sorry, A-R. You could also spell it S-H-A-W-K-A-R, Shakar. Sure, it's H-8266, for those that have a concordance. Hebrew 8266, Shakar. So this is, of course, this is the way Yah's people are anyway. They would never deal falsely. I believe Abraham knew the commandments of Yah. He walked with Yah, after all. He knows the ways of Yah. So he was, of course, he's not going to deal falsely with anyone. Now, I know that apparently Abimelech didn't quite understand at first why, and maybe he thought it was a falsity that Abraham had said that he was Sarah's brother. But, you know, we've gone over that. And maybe that's why he wants this covenant. But interesting thing is, the other part of this covenant is, firstly, not to deal falsely, but secondly, it says in verse 23, according to the kindness that I have done unto you, thou shalt do unto me. Wow. So as I have done love unto you, you love unto me. You know, that is cool. That is like a Yah thing anyway. Again, of course Abraham is A-okay with these things. Why not make a covenant about these things? Why not swear or seven oneself with another about these things, because these are ways of Yah. They truly are. You know? I mean, actually, Abraham is not covenanting here then that, well, if Abimelech now begins to fight with me, I can't fight with him. No, that's not a part of this here deal. This deal is, number one, don't deal falsely with me, which we know Abraham would never do. And number two, be kind unto me as I am kind unto you. And of course Abraham is that way. He does this all the time. He is Mr. Hospitality, you know? So, you know, it's a very simple swearing ceremony, most definitely. Now, I do know we're not to make covenant with wicked ones. And I don't believe Abimelech is truly a wicked one, you know? We don't know his heart. But I'll tell you, from what I've read so far, Abimelech's not such a bad guy. I think maybe he's got a little bit of Yah's heart in him, you know? I mean, he does rightful things. So he might be somewhat of a righteous man. It might just be in him. He may not have been shown, but he certainly has, you know, does things fairly. So, and he's certainly giving. I mean, he's given unto Abraham many things, much wealth, you know. But it's kind of cool too that Abraham shares with Abimelech this sevening concept. You know, he gives seven ewe lambs in verse 28. Seven sheba, same thing as swear sheba. Okay. Seven ewe lambs. And of course, you know, Abimelech is like, what do you mean by this? Well, it's the way we do things around here, bud. I might not be of your land, but this is the way my Elohim does things. You know, we take the sevens, we do things in sevens. It's a cool thing, trust me. You know, that'd be a, as Mark would say, this would be a Ken paraphrase. The place was called Beersheba. It's got the word Sheba in it, right? Sheba. Like Shabbat. Or Sheba as in seven. Yeah. I still don't really understand why Pichol is in here at all. But there's never a vain word. So, Mark, thanks for sharing what that meant, Mark. We should consider these things. He's actually later mentioned in Bereishit 26. So that's something to consider. Maybe that's why he's being mentioned here, because he's mentioned five chapters later again. I just find it interesting. I'm trying to learn these things. You know, it says that, and he planted a grove in verse 33. He planted a grove in Eshel, which is a tree, I guess, and called there unto the name of Yahuwah. So he planted a tree. That's something that the Jews do on occasion, right? They plant a tree in some types of commemoration. But two, that this is all about a well, right? I mean, it's really, you know, this whole idea of, guess why? Well, I'll let you answer that one. Mark, if you don't mind, please educate us when I'm done, okay? Because I just don't want to lose my train of thought right now. where was I? I already did it, didn't I? Oh, boy. Okay. It was all about a well, yeah. It was all about a well, and we know that often wells are really cool when it comes to, like, husband and wives meeting. But two, maybe there's more here that we need to consider, that this covenanting, this sevening, okay, this Sheba going on, is around a well, okay? It's the same thing that men and women do when they become husband and wife. Isn't that a covenant in itself? You know? Wouldn't it be wonderful if we all did such things around a well as it is in Scripture? I think that's pretty cool. Anyway, there's probably a little more to glean from that, and maybe someday I'll understand. Maybe someday y'all can show me these things. Because I'm not sure of that myself, but it's definitely a connection. So, anyway, that's all I have. Please, Mark. I didn't want to guess at the moment, but I'll let you share with what was on your mind. I yield the mic.
Thanks, Ken. I asked the question, and then I put what I think is the answer right next thing. You know, guess why he planted the tree. Okay, planted the tree, perhaps to mark the well. Okay, And this is the beginning of the tradition. The reason that the Jews plant trees, this is the first time we see that. Okay? This is the tradition. Abraham planted a tree. Okay? So Jews plant trees. And they do. They plant them all over the place. I mean, the point is that he just dug a well, puts a tree there to mark it, and also to memorialize his contract, this covenant with Abimelech. Okay? At this well. I dug this well. Here's a tree. I'm going to mark it. Now the tree, you're in a desert land. You see a tree in the middle of a desert. You got to think, must be some water around here. Because that thing's alive in the middle of this desert. And so I think that there were a number of reasons for him planting the tree. But the idea of the Jews planting trees, I think this is the beginning of it. Right here. First time, and then becomes a tradition for them. Now, you know, you do a halakha, you do something three times in a row, it's halakha. You can't break halakha then. So now they can't break halakha. Whenever they get a chance, they plant trees. Okay, are there other questions or comments on the Torah portion? I'm going to get ready to move to First Samuel chapter 1. In verse 21. Other questions or comments? If not, we're moving on. Okay, here we go. And the man Elkanah and all his house went up to offer unto Jehovah the yearly sacrifice and his vow. But Hannah went not up, for she said unto her husband, I will not go up until the child be weaned. She's already had the child. Okay, until the child be weaned. And then I will bring him that he may appear before Jehovah and there abide forever. Now this is the child Samuel. And Elkanah, her husband, said unto her, do what seemeth thee good. Tarry until thou have weaned him. Only Jehovah establish his word. So the woman abode and gave her son suck until she weaned him. And when she had weaned him, she took him up with her with three bullocks and one ephah of flour and a bottle of wine and brought him unto the house of Jehovah in Shiloh, and the child was young. And they slew a bullock and brought the child to Eli. And she said, O my master, thy soul liveth, my master. I am the woman that stood by thee here praying unto Jehovah. For this child I prayed, and Jehovah hath given me my petition, which I asked of him. Therefore also I have lent him to Jehovah. As long as he liveth, he shall be lent to Jehovah. And he worshipped Jehovah there. Now, is that he the child, or was that he Eli? Could be both. Okay, 21-28. Now Hannah, Elkanah's wife, was barren and went to the tabernacle to pray for a son. This is the background. She was so earnest in her prayer that she was actually mouthing the words without speaking them. Eli, the judge and high priest, saw her and assumed she was drunk, projecting his own faults, maybe. Could be, I think. Anyway, when he rebuked her, she explained that he blessed her and Elkanah. She immediately, well, as soon as it was practicable, conceived and bore a son and named him Shemuel, which means heard of Elohim. Shema El, heard of Elohim. I think the yearly sacrifice is the sacrifices offered every year at Yom Teruah. The phrase yearly sacrifice is unique in 1 Samuel, three times in chapters 1 and 2, and once in chapter 21. David's family had a yearly sacrifice as well. That one, chapter 21, and perhaps this one as well, was at Yom Teruah, for that coincided with the new moon celebration in Jerusalem. Yom Teruah is that of which Yeshua said, on that day and out of that day and hour, knoweth no man, in Matthew chapter 24. And is the only new moon that is a Mo'ad and a Shabbat of Yehovah in Leviticus chapter 23. Sorry, lunar Sabbath keepers, but it is true. Hannah had vowed before Yehovah that she would not go up to Jerusalem until she weaned Shemuel. When she told Elkanah, he could have denied her vow and made her go. But he affirmed her vow and took the rest of the fam for the yearly feast. Hannah weaned Shemuel at his time, which may have been in his third year. She was old enough then, he was old enough then, when she brought him to Eli, to be left in his care and to understand what was going on. Now, I assume that Hannah was training him for his entire life to serve Yehovah in the tabernacle. He may have actually been excited to serve if she trained him correctly. As we see in our actual passage in chapter 2, Israel was in dire need of a righteous priesthood and judge, as Eli knew that his sons were doing and did nothing to stop them from robbing the people to fulfill their own lusts. Of course, his only recourse was to accuse them to the Sanhedrin, and if they were found guilty, it would fall to Eli to throw the first stones. So, Yehovah not only gave Hannah and Elkanah a son, she gave Israel the righteous man she needed to lead the people. So Hannah loaned Shemuel to Yehovah for the rest of his life and brought him to Eli for his training. And Shemuel worshipped Yehovah in the tabernacle at age 3. The reason that Shemuel became a great man of Elohim was the upbringing he had from his mother and father. They prepared him for service to Yehovah and impressed on him the importance of what he would do. This is probably 100% out of phase with how Eli raised Hophni and Pinchas. For they knew more about how to take advantage of their positions than its performance's importance to Israel. This may be another tie to our Torah for today. Abraham may have been very lenient with Ishmael and allowed his mother to raise him as she saw fit. That would explain a lot. And I'm open to questions and comments on the Torah or the Haftarah. Any questions or comments? Raise your hand. I'll be happy to give you the mic. Or you could put it in the text, and I'll try to find it. It can be hard at this point. I said that this new moon was a Shabbat. This new moon, Yom Teruah, is a Shabbat. Okay? Yeah, I wasn't saying that the new moon is a Shabbat. No, it's not. Although many people celebrate each new moon, the only one that the scripture says is a Shabbat is the Shabbat of the new moon of the seventh month. Okay. Tom Moniz, your hand is up. You may take the mic.
One of the things I find interesting about this account is the youth aspect of it, how it takes a youth to clean up the house. And it's like the purity of the youth. And I see it also in the Yosef, I think we see it in the Yosef account too, how the youth was the... And we also see it in Job, because if you remember at the end of Job, after his friends, and I use quotation, air quotes, were done rebuking him, or however you want to put it, the youth steps up, Elihu, he steps up. And he speaks. And it's the same, that there's a lot of this aspect in the book, I think, this idea of, Yahshua ben Nun, the youth, who ministered to Moshe, and he was always in the tent, you know. There's something to that. Not exactly sure what it is. But I think it has to do with, grab them before they get corrupted, because us adults are corrupted, you know. And we corrupt our children.
Very good, Tom. You're absolutely right. Are there other questions or comments on the Torah or the Haftarah? I'm sorry, you asked what truth our truth and Ken? Did you post something that I didn't see? Who would be a priest? Verse 28, I'm sorry. Verse 28, who would be a priest? Let's go back and have a look at that. Therefore I have lent him to Yehovah. As long as he liveth, he shall be lent to Yehovah, and he worshiped Yehovah there. Who would be a priest? Shemuel would be a priest, I think. I think that's where you're coming from. Chapter 2. Oh, I'm sorry. Chapter 2 and verse 28. Let me look there. Let's see. Chapter 2 and verse 28. I did choose him out of all the tribes of Israel to be my priest. Let's go back. And the child Samuel grew up and was in favor both with Yehovah and also with men. And there came a man of Elohim to Eli, and said unto him, Thus saith Yehovah, did I plainly appear unto the house of thy father when they were in Egypt in Pharaoh's house? And I did choose him. That would have been probably Aharon. To burn incense and wear an ephod before me, and did I give unto the house of thy father all the offerings made by fire of the children of Israel? I think that's who we're talking about. Aharon and his sons were the priests, right? I don't know where that question came from, Clint Ken. That's from, I'm kind of. Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Anyway, are there other questions or comments on the Torah portion or the Haftarah? Questions or comments going once? Oh, I'm sorry. Did I read from 1 Samuel 1:28? Might have. It's possible. Oh, but I commented on 21 to 28. Oh, I read from 2:21 to 28. I read in chapter 2, didn't I? No, I did, 1:21. is what I had in my notes. That's what I read. Hannah went not up, for she said unto her husband, I will not go up until the child be weaned. I'm sorry. I'm lost. I don't know what you guys are talking about. Why don't we read chapter 2? Suppose we could. It's not the portion that I was talking about, though. But we can go ahead and look at it. 2:21-28. Nehovah visited Hannah so that she conceived and bare three sons and two daughters, and the child Samuel grew before Jehovah. Now Eli was very old and heard all this, all that his sons did unto all Israel, and how they lay with the women that assembled at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. He said unto them, Why do ye such things? For I hear of your evil dealings by all this people. Nay, my sons, for no good report that I hear. Ye make the Jehovah's people to transgress. This is exactly the same thing that Pinchas stopped in Numbers, you know, at the door of the tabernacle, where Cosby and, can't remember what the guy's name was now. Anyway, it was part of our TTRT this week, I think. What was the Israelite's name? Cosby was the Midianite woman. Anyway, that Pinchas went and pierced him through with one thrust of a spear and pinned him to the ground at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. And that's what Eli's sons are doing here. Yeah. Anyway, I'm sorry. I don't know where you're coming from on that, Ken. I read 1 Samuel 1:21-28, commented on it, and I don't know how we got into chapter 2. In the header. Oh, where did that come from? Oh, I'm sorry, in the header. That's not what I had posted in my notes. It's posted wrong in the header. Yeah. Yeah, if you go to my notes that are posted on us for Messianic WS. Oh, okay. Well. Ah, okay. I didn't check Messianic WS this year. They must have changed it for this year. Okay. My mistake. I'll have to go and look at it from now on. Anyway, then other questions or comments on the Torah portion or the Haftarah that I prepared for. Sorry, I'm going by my notes, not by the thing on Messianic WS. Anyway. I probably got commentary on that somewhere, but I don't have it ready right here handy. If there are no other questions or comments, we'll move on to Matthew chapter 1 and verses 18 to 25. Mark almost got red dotted. Sorry, Ken. Anyway, let's see about that. History, Matthew 1:18. Boom, here we go. Now the birth of Yeshua HaMashiach was on this wise. When, as his mother Miriam was espoused to Joseph, before they came together, she was found with child of Ruach HaKodesh. Then Joseph, her husband, being a tzaddik, okay, and being a tzaddik, was not willing to make her a public example, was minded to put her away privily. But while he thought on these things, behold, an angel of Jehovah, or of the master, rather, appeared unto him in a dream, saying, Joseph, thou son of David, fear not to take unto thee Miriam thy wife, for that which is conceived in her is of Ruach HaKodesh, and she shall bring forth a son, and thou shalt call his name Yeshua, for he shall save his people from their sins. Now all this was done, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken of the Master by the prophet, saying, Behold, a virgin shall be with child, and shall bring forth a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel, which being interpreted is Elohim with us. Then Joseph, being raised from sleep, did as the angel of Jehovah had bidden him, and took unto him his wife, and knew her not until she had brought forth her first son, and he called his name Yeshua. The third and most miraculous birth that we discuss today is Mashiach's. Each of the other miracle births was by a union of a husband and a wife. Mashiach's conception was by Ruach HaKodesh quickening the egg in Miriam and then indwelling it. The spirit of Mashiach is the spirit of Jehovah, while the flesh of Mashiach is human. The Son of Man could die. The spirit of Mashiach could not. Yeshua was thoroughly submitted to the Ruach from his conception, nothing wavering. His most purely human moment came in the Garden of Gethsemane when he asked Avinu to let the cup pass over. The Greek word is apo, above, over, away. Him. Okay, pass over him. Matthew 26, et al. By the way, the next day was Passover. So he's asking to pass over him. Yet willingly submitted to Avinu's will and be the Pesach lamb. He didn't wish to die any more than any person does. But he knew Jehovah's plan and was willing to do it because he was in the control of the Ruach of Jehovah, not a human spirit. Now, Jehovah, Miriam's husband, was a righteous man. He was a tzaddik. And he was not willing to make a public example of her. She was a pregnant, betrothed woman, pregnant not by her husband. Torah says that she and the other man are both guilty of a capital crime and need to be taken without the gates of the city and stoned to death. Yosef truly loved Miriam and wanted to put her away privily or in secret. But an angel from Jehovah visited him and told him that the child was by the Ruach, and that he should marry her immediately, regardless the appearance of impropriety or impatience. The angel called Yosef son of David. This is an appellation of the rightful heir of the throne of Chol Yisrael, the sons of the line of succession to the throne, and of Mashiach. It is used to refer to Shlomo, Chizkiyahu, Yoshiyahu, and other kings and their siblings, who were second or third in line for the throne. As such, when Yosef was told to take the child and to name him Yeshua, he was being told that Yeshua would be the last son of David, the Mashiach, and Mashiach, therefore. Yeshua would be the lawful heir to the throne as Yosef's legal son, if not his physical descendant. By naming him, Yosef was claiming Yeshua as his firstborn and heir. Meanwhile, the fact that Miriam was also a physical descendant of David made Yeshua a physical son of David as well. Every time you see the appellation, capital S, son of David, in either Tanakh or in the Brit Hadashah, it refers to either the king's heir or Mashiach or both. The angel speaking to Yosef commanded him to name the baby Yeshua. Please note the urgency of Yosef's obedience to the command of Jehovah's angel. There is absolutely no hesitation on his part to obey. He took Miriam to wife that day for two reasons. Number one, to obey Jehovah, and number two, to protect her honor. He also made sure that she was a perfect fulfillment of Isaiah 7:14 and maintained her virginity until after she bore Yeshua, and they named him at his circumcision, not to mention her time of purification that followed in Leviticus chapter 12, verses 1 to 4. Now, whether he did that on his own or he was told to do so by Yehovah, I can't tell you, but he did it. They had at least 6 other children, 4 sons who were named, and at least 2 daughters. There has been, for nearly 2,000 years now, a controversy over the prophecy quoted in verse 23. Did Matityahu mistranslate Isaiah, or not? The controversy did not exist until he wrote his gospel, and Gamaliel wrote his parody of it. There is a better word for the use to use for virgin in Hebrew. Betula always means virgin. Where Alma can and usually does mean virgin, but technically means young woman. But in order for the Isaiah prophecy to have an immediate fulfillment in Yeshayahu's day, Alma was the correct word to use. In its immediate fulfillment, Matityahu, or rather in its ultimate fulfillment, Matityahu and numerous old-timey Jews who translated it into Greek or copied it to the Qumran manuscripts gets it right. See the appendix of the Aramaic English New Testament on page 709. I'm going there. Aramaic English New Testament, page 709, entitled Alma. It's 5.5 pages of 10-point type, so sit back and relax, because you're going to read it all. On page 709, Alma. This is the first of the appendices in this book. These appendices make this book worth buying. If you haven't got an Aramaic English New Testament, I suggest you get one. Just for the appendices and the notes throughout this New Testament. This is taken from the Kaboris text, I'm pretty sure, of Aramaic text. And it's translated by, according to the book anyway, by Andrew Gabriel Roth. Here we go. Alma. Sit back and relax. It's going to take a while. Over the past 2,000 years, perhaps no passage of Scripture has elicited more controversy between Jews and Christians than the virgin or maiden of Isaiah chapter 7 and verse 14. Modern rabbinical Jews insist that the prophet is writing about people and events, including himself and his family, that are rooted solely in his time and therefore cannot be relevant to the birth of Yeshua some 700 years later. Christians, on the other hand, insist with equal fervor that the word in question, Alma, refers to a virgin birth that would have nothing to do with Isaiah at all. Both are wrong. That's me. Their studies often focus on how Alma is rendered as virgin in 2 key translations of the Tanakh that were done prior to the controversy. Regardless of our personal perspectives, one Jew 2 millennia ago took a radical view of this passage and greatly influenced the entire field of biblical studies, only to have his unique vision lost, even to his most ardent supporters. His name, Levi Bar Alphaeus, known more popularly to the world as the Apostle Matthew. To rabbinical Jews, Matthew was a heretic, plain and simple. However, recent scholarship, such as Paul Bradshaw's Passover and Easter, Origin and History to Modern Times, by University of Notre Dame Press, 2000, copyright 2000, suggests that the rabbi's ancient counterparts were not so closed-minded. The first century rabbi Gamaliel, tutor to the Apostle Paul in Acts 22, 1 and 2, and grandson of the great rabbi Hillel, is recorded as having written a parody on Matthew's gospel in Hebrew. That is, in Hebrew letters, but in the Aramaic language. There is no question that Ketav Ashuri script was used for both Hebrew and Aramaic inscriptions in 1st century Israel. That's Gamaliel's book. Now, that was a note. Go back to the beginning. Here we go. That being the case, that Rav Gamaliel wrote this parody in Matthew's Gospel, that being the case, it would have required the rabbi to have at least read the Gospel in the first place and become familiar with its approach and terminology. It's also worth pointing out that large portions of Yeshua's parables were copied and inserted almost verbatim into the Talmud 200 years later. Furthermore, the picture that continues to emerge is that there was a frequent dialogue and mutual influence between the Nazarene and rabbinic camps during the first century, which later editions of the Mishnah tried to edit out of their official records. However, fortunately for us, they did not completely succeed. The strongest aspect, first to the Jews. Now, this is that's the introduction. Now, a break, and it says, first to the Jews. This is, he's going to tell you how they saw it. The strongest aspect of the Jewish argument on Isaiah 7:14 is also the most obvious. It's called reading the first 13 verses before talking about verse 14. To wit, read it in context. In the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, son of Uzziah, king of Judah, Rezin, the king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, the king of Israel, came up to Jerusalem to wage war against it, but they could not conquer it. When the house of David was told, Syria is in league with Ephraim, his heart and the heart of his people shook as the trees of the forest shake before the wind. And Jehovah said to Isaiah, go forth and meet Ahaz, you and Shear Yashub, your son, at the end of the conduit of the upper pool in the highway of the fuller's field, and say to him, take heed, be quiet, do not fear, and do not let your heart be faint because of these two smoldering stumps of firebrands, as the fierce anger of Rezin and Syria and the son of Remaliah, because Syria, with Ephraim and the son of Remaliah, has devised evil against you, saying, let us go up against Judah and terrify it, and let us conquer it for ourselves, and set up the son of Tabael as king in the midst of it. Thus says Yehovah Elohim, it shall not stand, and it shall not come to pass. For the head of Syria is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is Rezin. Within 65 years, this is in parentheses now, within 65 years, Ephraim will be broken to pieces, so that it will no longer be a people. And the head, and then that's the end of the parenthesis. And the head of Ephraim is Samaria, and the head of Samaria is the son of Remaliah. If you will not believe, surely you shall not be established. Again, Jehovah spoke unto Ahaz, ask a sign of Jehovah your Elohim. Let it be deep as Sheol or high as heaven. But Ahaz said, I will not ask, and I will not put Jehovah to the test. And he said, hear then, O house of David, is it too little for you to weary men that you weary my Eloah as well? If Isaiah 7, 1 to 13, that's the end of chapter 13, or verse 13. If Isaiah 7, 13 sets the scene for us, this is what we know. The start of Isaiah's prophecy in this chapter is rooted during his day, specifically the time of King Ahaz, and not seven centuries later. In fact, as early as verse 3, we see Yehovah telling Isaiah to speak these words of comfort to Ahaz directly. Second, the time limit for this prophecy is clearly established in verse 8 as 65 years. So once again, this is not talking about Yeshua's day. Number 3, the sign that is about to be revealed in verse 14 is one that Yehovah prompts Ahaz to ask of him, yet another indicator tying the prophecy to the time of Isaiah. Therefore, it is only with this background that the next line can be interpreted. Therefore, Yehovah himself will give you a sign. Behold, a young woman, Alma, shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Immanuel. He shall eat curds and honey when he knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good. For before the child knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land before whose two kings you are in dread will be deserted. Let me wet my whistle here. Okay. Continuing on. Still quoting from the ANT. As we can easily see, the birth of Emmanuel is within the lifetime of these two earthly kings mentioned earlier. So where is Yeshua in all of this? The rabbis rightly ask. In fact, if you follow the line to the end of chapter 7, even well into chapter 8, there is no indication of a future well beyond the 65-year window that the prophet himself gives. That being the case, by this reasoning, Matthew's direct quoting of this passage in support of a virgin birth seems at best misguided and at worst irresponsibly deceptive. End of that passage to the Jews first, and then to the Christians. Okay. The Christian side of this argument has the unfortunate general and prevailing attitude that the Tanakh should simply be ignored in favor of the higher revelation of the New Testament. There is no higher revelation in the New Testament than there is, this is me by the way, than there is in the Tanakh. It's all one revelation. It all comes from the same Elohim. Okay? It's all as equally inspired as the rest. Okay? Back to the quotation. This particular attitude, however, was condemned by another group of very pious and Orthodox Jews, straight out of the New Testament, who warned us to keep the Torah at all costs. James, John, Peter, Luke, and Paul, who made comments such as the following. Do we nullify the Torah through faith? Jehovah forbid, rather we establish the Torah. That's in Romans 3:31. You can also look at Luke chapter 16 and verse 17, Romans 7:12, James 1:22-25, and chapter 2, verses 8-10, and 1 Peter 1:23-25, 2 Peter 1:19, 1 John 3:4, and Revelation 12:17. That's where all of those guys wrote down that the Torah, that you're supposed to do Torah. Now, the rabbinical school points out that Alma means young woman, as does the New King James Version Christian translation. When the Christian then asks, but it says it's a sign. So what is so miraculous about a young woman bearing a son and calling him a common Jewish name? The rabbi has a ready-made answer. Put simply, Yehovah is clearly asking Ahaz to select a miracle that will make the king feel more confident. Then in line 14, Isaiah says to Ahaz that because he did not pick a sign, Yehovah would pick one for him. But not exclusively for Ahaz alone, as we'll see later on. Okay, he's going to pick one for him. This young woman, who turns out to be Isaiah's wife and a prophetess in her own right, is herself a sign by her very existence, as well as the existence of her son. In other words, the pregnancy alone is the sign of encouragement that Yehovah is giving to Ahaz. That's a perfectly reasonable explanation, too, by the way. Moving on. When the Christian follows up with the fact that Rebecca, who was a virgin, is also called Alma, the priests show Proverbs 30, verses 18 through 20, where an adulteress is called the same thing. And I'm going to read the note for this. This reading, linking the adulterous woman with Alma, is granted somewhat controversial. Nevertheless, it is easy to see why such a linkage is likely held among rabbinic adherents. They are probably right, but the distance of those two words in the text makes a definitive verdict impossible. The bottom line is that I am willing to grant the full agreement to the rabbis in this instance because even if everything they say is true, their fundamental flaw is not seeing the embedded characteristics of Isaiah 7 through 9 remains. Okay, now, that was this note. Back to the quoting the text. As if that was not bad enough, the rabbis can even show that the most ancient version of Isaiah, the Dead Sea Scrolls, also says Alma. And there's another note, note number 6. I'm going to read that. But as good as the rabbinical argument is, it also has a serious flaw, a nasty, snaking crack in its otherwise perfect interpretive wall. Behold, a Parthenos, virgin in Greek, will conceive and bear a son, and you will call him Emmanuel, Isaiah chapter 7 and verse 14, Septuagint reading from about 250 BCE. The Septuagint is a translation into Greek of the Tanakh, okay? And it's translated into Greek by rabbis and scribes who picked the proper word for this thing. And we're not talking about just a young woman. They could have used a couple of Greek words to say that. That's not what they did. They picked Parthenos, which can be translated no other way than virgin. Okay. The Jewish scholars from Jerusalem knew Isaiah 7:14 relates to Isaiah's time, and, more to the point, they knew Isaiah's wife did not have a virgin birth and translated Alma into the virgin exclusive term, Parthenos, anyway. How could that be Christian bias then, if the translation was done by Jews more than 2 centuries before Yeshua was even born? Now, here's what the Jews of Babylon, whose descendants helped compile the Talmud, wrote in their Aramaic version of Isaiah almost 200 years later. Behold, a Betola, virgin, shall conceive and bear a son, and you will call him Emmanuel. That is Isaiah 7:14, Aramaic Peshitta Tanakh, reading as circa 100 BCE. It was written in 100 BCE, and the Aramaic says Betola, which is the Aramaic cognate of the Hebrew, Betula. Once again, we see virgin-exclusive terminology, and this time by a Jewish group universally acknowledged by biblical scholars to be much closer to the apostolic age than the LXX redactor. That's the Septuagint redactor. Furthermore, the fact is, there is an ancient Hebrew variant behind both the LXX and the Peshitta Tanakh reading, as is testified by both groups involved in their respective works. Now, let's compare the Greek with the Aramaic. Behold, a Parthenos will conceive and bear a son. Behold, a Betola will conceive and bear a son. Both from Matthew 1:23. Suddenly Matthew is not as simple as some might posture. Here's a man adding his voice to the traditions of his own scholarly ancestors, since these are the exact same words. There are all kinds of definitions of the word virgin, but let's take a look at the definition the Torah gives it for marriageable maiden. In Genesis chapter 24, in verse 16, the girl was very beautiful, a virgin, and that is Betula or Parthenos, depending on which language you're looking at it in. And no man had had relation with her, and she went down to the spring and filled her jar and came up. And not only did they call her Betula, but they then said, no man had known her. Okay? I mean, can't be anything else. And that refers to Rivka. Then, in Leviticus chapter 21 and verse 13 and 14, it says, a widow or a divorced woman, or one who is profaned by harlotry, that he, the high priest, may not take, but rather he is to marry a Betula, Parthenos, of his people. Okay, he's to marry a virgin. Turning the page. Then the parent, this is from Deuteronomy chapter 22 and verses 13 through 19. Then the parent shall display a cloth before the elders of the town, and the elders shall take a man and punish him. They shall fine him 100 shekels of silver and give them to the girl's father, because this man has given an Israelite virgin, Bethula, Parthenos, depending on which language, a bad name. She will continue to be his wife. He must not divorce her as long as he lives. Okay, that's Deuteronomy 22:13-19. And that is, and by the way, that talks about Hamotzi Shemra, creating an evil name. Okay, and that's what they're talking about there. When that guy said that this woman's not a virgin, he was lying. Okay, now, so it was Lashon Hara, and it was also Hamotzi Shemra, both. Now, Deuteronomy chapter 23 through 24. If a man happens to meet in town a virgin, that is Bethula, Parthenos, pledged to be married, and he sleeps with her, he shall take both of them to the gate of that town and stone them to death. Then in Isaiah chapter 62 and verse 5, for as a young man marries a virgin, Bethula, Parthenos, so your sons will marry you. And as the bridegroom rejoices over the bride, so Elohim will rejoice over you. Then Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 32, can a virgin, Bethula, Parthenos, forget her ornaments or a bride her attire? Yet my people have forgotten me days without number. Then in Joel chapter 1 and verse 8, wail like a virgin, Bethula, Parthenos, girded with sackcloth for the bridegroom of her youth. Put simply, there is not a single biblical reference to a Bethula or a Parthenos having had sexual relations prior to meeting their husbands. Torah, however, does allow for a virgin who is seduced to be married to a man who forced himself on her. In that case, while technically the Bethula did have sex, she is not blamed and retains that title, because the man who took her virginity did shortly thereafter become her husband, just as a regular young maiden who was not seduced would have been. That's exact in Exodus chapter 22 and verse 16. So, that's the end of to the Christian, and also to the Christian. Now we're going to the next thing, the Alma connection. Let me wet my whistle again. Coffee's cooling off. Thus far, we have only discussed two meanings of the word Alma, that of young woman and virgin. These are the two meanings that are most apparent given the context of the passage. However, Hebrew has a tendency to have additional meanings heaped onto a given collection of letters that are not necessarily the exact same word, but nevertheless are valid owing to the divine arrangement of every stroke of every letter. If we then can study the numerical value of Hebrew words in an attempt to understand their deep relationships, then surely looking at identical spelling configurations and their concordant meanings is an equally beneficial pursuit. In terms of the gematria, of course, these words would be related to one another anyway, because of their numerical values would be identical. Going by this standard, then, Alma does not just have two meanings that are relevant to our story, but five. And these meanings would very well be the key that unlocks Matthew's understanding of Isaiah 7:14. Without going into much further detail, however, it is also important to note that in Ezekiel chapter 36, verses 24 to 27, the nations are scattered throughout the earth, and this references the wider world, which also happens to be a phrase spelled the same as Alma. And behold, I am with you always, even unto the end of the world. Alma. Okay, Matthew 28, verse 20. And of course, Yeshua is called the light of the world. Alma. In John chapter 1, verse 4, and in 9:5. Marrying the dual meanings of the light, Torah, and the young woman, world, perfectly. There is also a clear linkage between the light of men in John 1:4, and the light of the nations language in Isaiah. On the other hand, that line in Matthew 28:20 can also be read another way, due to yet another meaning of the phrase, "And behold, I am with you always, even unto the end of the age." Alma can mean age or world. Interestingly enough, the Greek word aion, which is also used here, means world and age, one of the few times such a precise match between languages has been found in their respective versions of the renewed covenant. Be that as it may, however, the fact is world and eternity are ideas bound together in Hebraic thought. When the rabbis, for example, talk about Olam Haba, Alma and Olam have the same numerical value. When the rabbis, for example, talk about Olam Haba, the world that is to come, it is also known as an eternal place. Surely then, the use of Alma by Isaiah, when more precise terms could have been utilized, hints that there is more to this prophecy than a young woman bearing a son named Emmanuel. This son, instead, is the shadow of the type of another son, who is born of and whose goings forth are from eternity, Micah 5:1 and 2. And yet he also rules the world, in Daniel 7, verses 1 to 13. End of the Alma connection, going on to the rest of the vision, and we've got about a page and a half left here. As the rest of Isaiah 9 unfolds, it becomes clear that the infant being talked about here is not the same one that began in Isaiah's time two chapters earlier. We see why. Thou hast multiplied the nation, thou hast increased its joy. They rejoice before thee as with joy at the harvest, as men rejoice when they divide the spoil. For the yoke of his burden and the staff of his shoulder, the rod of his oppressor, thou hast broken as on the day of Midian. For every boot of the tramping warrior in battle tumult, and every garment rolled in blood will be burned as fuel for the fire. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty Elohim, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and of peace there shall be no end, upon the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and with righteousness from this time forth and forevermore. The zeal of Jehovah of hosts will do this. So after the people in Galilee see a great light, the conditions at that time also appear ripe for war. Can this be an apt description of the troubles of King Ahaz with Syria? Absolutely. However, it is equally apt to the position Jews found themselves in 7 centuries later, after the oppression of the Roman Empire. So here again we see the shadow of chapter 7 was manifest itself in chapter 9. Obviously, Isaiah's own child is not called Wonderful Counselor, because we already know the name of that child is Maher Shalal Hashbaz in Isaiah chapter 8 and verse 3, since that portion of the prophecy is still within the 65-year port window. Isaiah would also surely not name his son the Mighty Elohim, the Everlasting Father, because that would be blasphemous. However, those titles would be appropriate for a promised Messiah whom Isaiah himself referred to as a righteous branch, and to having the Spirit of Jehovah rest upon him in Isaiah 11, verses 1 and 2. Because the Spirit of Jehovah is that of the Mighty Elohim and the Everlasting Father, since they are one and the same. As for the rest of the portion, "and the government will be on his shoulder," cannot refer to Isaiah's child either, because only the king's descendants had the right to rule in Israel. And so, even though the sign of Isaiah's newborn son was meant for Ahaz, that son cannot be the ruler referred to here in chapter 9, and yet Alma links them both. Then, as if this were not a strong enough point, we are told that this child's government is eternal and that he himself will rule forever, something that even Ahaz and his descendants could rightly claim. Nothing, rather, something that not even Ahaz and his descendants could rightfully claim. The text literally reads that he will uphold it now and forevermore. Notice that after 9:7, another stray letter appears, a Samech. Its appearance and symbolism tells us that the long-term prophecy is now even sealed up. Now also sealed up. And the balance of chapter 9 shifts back to present and near future. This was done at the key juncture between 8:15 and 8:16, when the short-term prophecy was also sealed symbolically and by direct reference with the same letter. However, before wrapping this up, it's fair to ask where the last meaning of Alma, namely virgin, is finally found. The answer is in the lines we just looked at, because in order to have a ruler live forever, as in 9:1 through 5 clearly states, that person must also be without sin, because the soul that sins surely dies. So if sin prevents us from immortality, as is clearly the case with Adam and Eve, then it stands to reason that another process must occur in order for that person to escape the inheritance of Adam. This seems to be why Matthew saw the Alma word in Isaiah 7:14 as a root from which multiple lexical branches sprang, reaching all the way to the time when he would have to talk about another Alma, this time a virgin, conceiving and bearing a son. In doing so, Matthew then saw the same thing that the compilers of the LXX and Peshitta Tanakh did, and therefore, quoting the first part, 7:14, in Matthew's mind, must have been tantamount to bringing all these future shadow-type extra meanings also to the table. Furthermore, Matthew surely would have seen the Zechariah 12:10 image of Yehovah saying, "He was pierced, but they mourned for him, the suffering servant, as the only begotten son." The word in Hebrew, yachid, is an exclusive singularity, meaning that the rules for Messiah could never apply to anyone else, either before or since Yeshua. Hence, referring to 7:14 and then parts of Isaiah 9 just a little bit later, in chapter 4 and verses 15 and 16, was sufficient for the gospel writer to make his case from Tanakh. And finally, it's probably also the case that Matthew himself expected his readers to search the scriptures to see why he made the choices he did, which may also go a long way to explaining why Matthew quotes from Tanakh 128 times, way more than any other gospel writer. And that's the end of Alma from the Aramaic English New Testament. I'm sorry that took so long, but it's very important stuff. If you don't have an AENT, please save the money, do whatever you have to do to buy one. It's worth the money just for the appendices. That was the first one. And I'm open to questions and comments on Matthew chapter 1, verses 18 to 28. But before you go there, let me remind you that I'm going to now share with you what I've got from my little treatise called The Life of Yeshua HaMashiach and Hebraic Perspective. And I'm going to give you that in a couple of minutes. Any questions or comments? AENT, Aramaic English New Testament. I am promoting it. I don't make any money on it. Wait a minute. Let me tell you where to go to get this, because I have a friend that does make money on it. Okay? It's at AE Bible, AEBIBLE.com. The guy's name is Marty Hurst. He's a friend of mine. If you'll buy it from him, he'd appreciate it. That is aebible.com. Flamebot has a question. I'm sorry. I didn't see it. Is it? It's in the text more than likely, huh? I have no idea. I've never seen it. Messianic Eagle. Let me look to see if I can find Flamebot's question. It's probably way up in the text. Flamebot, can you just take the mic and ask your question on the mic? Or can you put it back in the text again near the bottom? I'm not going to be able to find it in there. Ah, okay. Does the virgin woman have a say-so in marrying the guy that took her by force? I would expect, yeah. I would expect. I'm not absolutely certain. I know this, that the prospective bride had the choice whether to marry or not marry the guy that was asking her to marry her. Okay, even if the fathers got together and made an arrangement, and he already paid the bride price, the bride could still refuse, and then the money would change hands again, and you know that would be that. She could refuse. I don't know about the. I would expect that she has a choice whether to marry him or not. But I think her father would probably look to keeping her good name, you know, that she married the man that took her. If the guy was looking for her. I don't know. That would... Personally, if it was me and it was my daughter, I would just take the guy outside the gates and stone him. But that's... Messianic Eagle, you think you may have an answer for that? Raise your hand. Okay, take the mic.
Yeah. Well, when Diana asked that, the first thing that came to my mind was... Devarim, or Deuteronomy, chapter 2, verses 27 and 28. Basically, that's from what I can tell is by force. Today in America, we'd call it rape, I think. and he has to take on the responsibility because he has humbled her. Now, I'm not recalling exactly where, though, Mark, but there's a thing where the father can refuse anyway and not let them get married. Because basically, if you look in Deuteronomy, let's see, gosh darn typing, okay, if you look in, like, read all of Deuteronomy 30, she's basically under the father's authority anyway. She can't even, I mean, she can make an oath and he can either bind it or forbid it, and that's before she gets married and it goes under his. I'm sorry, you're right, disciple. I screwed up. No, thank you for correcting me. I meant Numbers 30. That's, anyway. But there's a specific scripture in there, and I could probably try to Google it, where the father can refuse to let that man who basically humbled his daughter. And I think that might, and I just don't know where it is right now. I just can't think about it. So he does have a choice in that. I don't know. I think they pass it on to, like, the uncle or something like that. Keep in mind, too, you also have, and this is Deuteronomy. I'm not brain spacing on this one. But on decisions that aren't concrete, that they have to get the elders together and they make a decision, you can look at Deuteronomy 17, verses 8 through 12, where that could qualify. Adam 149. So anyway, that's about all I have on that. Annie, you're up.
Well, before Annie's up, I'm up. what we do here is when you're done, I thank you, by the way. Very good commentary. I appreciate that. And recognize the next person to come up. We don't just jump, hand the mics off. But anyway, yes, the father definitely can disavow his wife's or his daughter's covenants with anyone if, when he first hears it, he says, no, it's not going to work. And for that reason, it's Adam's sin that caused all of our problems, not Chava's. Chava ate the fruit first. She's the first one to make a covenant with death. And Abraham could have said, I refuse this covenant. And that would be that. I refuse my wife's need to keep this covenant. And there would have been, everything would have been just fine based on Numbers chapter 30. Okay? He could disavow her covenant. And he didn't. Yes, I am the mark that you met at Bet Tikkun. That's my son goes to Bet Tikkun. I do this because most of these people that come in here are without a fellowship anywhere, and usually, or quite probably, hundreds of miles from the nearest one. You know, that's why we have this room open. Now, there may be people that are in the middle of the town and there's a good messianic fellowship right around the corner. If that's the case, if it was me, I would go there, you know. But, you know, anyway, that's all. And Sarah's daughter, your hand is up. You may take the mic. Take it away.
I'm one of those without a fellowship except for this room. I would think that it, you know, in this honor and shame society, that by the man knowing, if you rape a woman, which would render her, you know, with shame and would not be able to marry anyone else. So to carry with it this concept of you take another woman outside of a covenant, you're still going to be responsible for her. I would think that would be very much, you know, I mean, at this time, women didn't go out and hold jobs with insurance, et cetera, et cetera. So it's as much a part of the, you know, consequences. Would it mean, and this would be my question to anybody who would know the society, it wouldn't mean that she would have to still live with him, though, would it? Wouldn't it be more about him being responsible for her clothing, etc.? I mean, we're not talking Western society, where, or even Islam, you know. Do you know the society messianic, the ancient Near Eastern? Because I don't know that would be required as much as it's about him having to take care of her. In terms of clothing, food, even a roof over her head. Mark, your mic.
Thank you, Sarah. I'm not sure about that. Maybe Messianic Eagle does have something to say, or someone else has an idea. I'm not certain if she would have to live with her husband, but I would think so. But I don't know for sure. And Messianic Eagle, your hand's up. You may take the mic.
Okay, thanks, Mark. I thought you were the Mark I knew that we met almost a couple of years ago at that Friday night lamb roast. And every now and then, like, we'd get together. Dave would come, and we'd go outside after we were done with Oneg. And I'd see it was awesome. It was awesome. But I'd go out there and holler a line, you know, and say the sacred name, Yad Heh Waweh, and Yad Heh Vav Heh, blessed be his name. And then Dave's a big boy, too. I mean, he can really belt that shofar out. He's real good at it. But anyway, back to Annie's question. if they agreed to let him get married, yes, they lived together. No. If she's not married, how could it be adultery? It could be rape and fornication, but that's only if she's married to somebody else for adultery to qualify. Now, I'm not saying that, I don't want to sit here and say that I understand, well, what text are you referring to? Because you're talking approximately 3,600 years ago with Moshe. I mean, I think we can understand it to an extent, but I think it's awfully arrogant for me or anybody else to sit here and say, hey, I understand that society from back then. That's just utterly ridiculous. I mean, I think we know a lot, but it was a totally different deal back then. I've done my best to dive into it and study the scriptures and listen to other people's commentaries, a lot of messianic leaders in the world, and I think that helps. But the fact of the matter is I have a lot of Americanism ingrained into me. Bedrothal was a legal marriage. But if they agreed after, like in Deuteronomy 22 verses 28 and 29, and that's not the only place, it's just the one that comes to mind, yeah, they lived together as a couple, and yes, he had to take care of her. If the father, the earthly father, agreed to it in the first place, that's about the best I can give you. But hold on. But if a man be trialed, damsel in the field, and force her lie with her, she'll die. Yeah, it's verse 25. I'm thinking of... Give me a second here, folks. I'm not trying to take up too much time. I just think it was a totally different society, and they didn't look at things the way we do now. I don't think... I'm speculating, but I don't think they looked at things in that area the way those people in that area think now. I just don't see how we could. But I'm thinking of verse 28... If a man find a damsel that is a virgin, which is not betrothed, and lay hold on her, and lie with her, and they be found, then the man that lay with her shall give unto the damsel's father 50 shekels of silver, and she shall be his wife. Because he hath humbled her, he may not put her away all his days. A man shall not take his father's wife. Okay, never mind that. Verse 30. But anyway, that's the best I can come up with. It wasn't looked at the same way it is now. So, it's a totally different ballgame. But, anyway. And we could get into different deals of how marriage occurs. They had ceremonies and stuff that they did. But then again, think about it. They didn't have a wedding and a chapel to go to. Adam and Eve, you know. Adam and Kafkaw. All they had was, God said, Adam, she's bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, you know. And basically, they were a couple. They were helpmeets. That's about all I got. Mark, you're up.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate all that. Yes, a betrothal in biblical days in Israel, and Hebraic way of thinking. A betrothal is a valid legal marriage. Now, it's not consummated until the actual party, okay, where the vows are taken between each other before human witnesses, before Elohim, and then there's penetration afterwards. That's when the covenant is complete, okay? But the betrothal is the agreement. It's a covenant entered into by the woman and the man with the father's blessing. Okay? And that's it. They're married. Now, the way it worked back then, and at least usually, was that the man would go and the boy, we'll call him that, the young man, would go to his father and say, I'd like to marry this woman, get with her father and make the arrangements. Right? The fathers would get together and they would make an arrangement. Then the son would, the son of the first guy, would take a gift and a glass of wine, and he would go to the girl and he would give her the gift and he would ask her to marry him. He would say, I'm going to, this cup represents my lifeblood that I promise to give for you. Okay? I will do everything that is necessary to keep you well. Okay? And I will give my very life to protect you. Okay? Then he would take a sip of the wine and hand her the glass. And if she took the glass and took a sip, the betrothal was finalized. That's it. We're betrothed. From that point, the boy would then go back to his father's house and prepare a place for her. The daughter would go back to her mother's house, and she would learn to be a good wife. And they would do that for as long as it took, until the father of the groom would tell his son that your house is ready, your business is ready, go and get your wife. It could take a year, could take 2 years. Okay? Go and get your wife. He would go and get her, bring her back to his father's house. They would have a ceremony. All right? She would walk around him, you know, the 7 times that they do that. Okay? They would do the whole ceremony. They would have a big hoedown, as it were. Okay? Have a great party. And then the new husband and wife would go into the tent and consummate the marriage. We just read a couple of minutes ago, somebody did, about him bringing out the proof of her virginity. Okay, which was a cloth that was laid under them, and the blood of her virginity is on that thing. He would take that out to the father, her father, and give it to him. And now that's the proof that she was a virgin when she was married. Okay, and now if he brings a charge against her that she wasn't a virgin, father brings that thing out, and he can never make that accusation again. Okay? Can never make that accusation again, and he must never divorce her. Because he has told the entire nation of Israel that his wife, who was a virgin, was not a virgin. Lashon Hara and Hamotzi Shemra. We read that earlier. So, very, very important stuff, okay? And look at the imagery of Yeshua on the night he's about to go out to the Garden of Gethsemane with his disciples, and he takes that glass of wine, and he says, "This is the blood of the covenant shed for you. Take ye all and drink of it." And he passes it around. And they all drink of it, including Judas. They all knew exactly what that was. It was a betrothal ceremony. It's absolutely amazing. Anyway, Disciple Nazarene, your hand is up. You may take the mic.
Shalom. Hopefully you can hear this. This is the mic test for the entire room. Okay, so we've got the prophecy of the virgin birth. So I want to bring forth this opinion. Hopefully you're, or at least some of you, are familiar with the concept of a Gezerah Shavah. A Gezerah Shavah is where you can link different texts together because they use the same word. And because you can link different verses together, you can bring their context together because of the same phrase or word that's being used. And I think that this is one of the rules that is underpinning why in the Gospel of Matthew, we have this prophecy concerning the virgin birth. So, just bear with me, what I'll do. I'll post Isaiah 7:14. Copy. I'm going to point something out. Now, there's been some commentary about the word Alma, but here in the Hebrew, there's an addition. It's Ha-Alma, the Virgin. And the Hebrew, it looks like this. So that is Ha-Alma. When you get to the Gospels, which are in Greek, if you look to the Greek, you'll see that it also reflects this understanding. It doesn't say virgin, it says the virgin. And I think that that's a key point that we have to take into consideration. Now, this phrase here, the virgin, or ha'alma, is actually very rare in the Tanakh. It only happens in two places. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to post the two places where ha'alma is, and then I'll have some additional commentary, because I think that there's a key here. No one's asking the question, why is Mary called Mary? Mary in the Hebrew would be Miriam. So no one's asking the question, why was this name chosen for the mother of Yeshua? I think that there's a very significance, there's a great significance in the name, and it relates to the Virgin. Now, I'm going to post you two locations where this phrase, ha'alma, is used. So just bear with me. I will. Okay. So the one location is in Exodus 2:8. Let me just try and copy this. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to post it in the Hebrew first. I'm going to try and walk you through this step by step. So here, I'm going to post the word again. It's ha'alma. Okay. This word here. So I'm going to post you the English translation, if you just bear with me. Okay, so this is the English translation, and this verse uses the phrase ha'alma, not just simply alma, but ha'alma. Now, there's one other verse that uses this phrase ha'alma, and I'm going to try and post it for you, bear with me. So the other location is in Genesis. And I'm going to show you where, again, it uses the phrase ha'alma. So there are two locations in the Tanakh where this phrase ha'alma is used. The ha, I believe, is very important because it makes a distinction within the text when it's speaking about alma, but ha'alma has additional meaning. Now, here's a trivia question for you. Ha'alma is the virgin. Here's a trivia question for you. What was the name of the mother of Moshe? Does anyone know? Hopefully you do. Okay. What was the name of his sister? Miriam. The sister of Moshe was Miriam. And Miriam is connected to ha'alma. And when you get to the Gospel of Matthew, we've got a virgin who's called Mary. Now, when you get to Genesis, the verse that I posted up there, if you look at the direct context, it's about getting a wife, i.e. a woman or ha'alma who's betrothed, if you look at the surrounding context. So I think that there's a reason why Miriam is called Miriam in the Gospel of Matthew. She's called ha'alma, and she was betrothed. Because if you link both texts together using the Gezerah Shavah interpretive rule, you can link the two contexts together now. So when you get to Exodus, it links you can link the name Miriam to Alma. And when you get to Genesis, you can link the concept of a woman who's betrothed to the concept of a Ha'alma. Now, according to the rule, what you would do, you would link both of these contexts together. And what do you get? You get a virgin, or the virgin, who is betrothed, who is called Miriam. I would say that the usage of Ha'alma with the Ha is very significant in this context. And this is what's happening. This is what Matthew is identifying. And so anciently what would have happened is they would have linked these two texts together. These two texts would have formed an expectation to be fulfilled. And so when we get to the context of the Gospels, it's very significant that the mother of Yeshua is called Miriam, because the name Miriam is identified with Ha'alma. She's betrothed. Well, a woman who's betrothed is connected to this concept of Ha'alma. This phrase only happens in two places in the entire Tanakh. It just so happens to be in those contexts. So, with this interpretive rule in mind, that would link the two contexts together, it would form an expectation to be fulfilled. And so I would say that that would be the driving force behind why the author of, or in the Gospel of Matthew, he's identifying this prophecy. But I'm just bringing that to the table. Hopefully that made sense. So with that, Mike is free. Sure.
Yeah, I caught the relationship as soon as you talked about first of all the Gezerah Shavah and the Miriam and the Miriam. I'm sorry, that's enough for me. That's a wonderful point. I really like that. Are there any other questions or comments on the Torah portion, the Haftarah, or the Brit Hadashah so far? I'm going to be moving on and commenting again on Matthew 1:18-25 in somewhat greater detail than what we did. Are there any other questions or comments? And I'm sorry, by the way, 2 Corinthians 5:11 and Lady of Wisdom, but we have red dot text on, and if we don't know you or no one else in the room knows you, if I can't get a voucher that you're okay, you got to leave the red dot on. We have had troubles with trolls coming in here and just giving us nothing but a hard time, and we're worried about the shalom, the peace in the room. Okay, so if you know somebody in the text, I am them, and ask them if they'll vouch for you. If we get somebody in the room to vouch for you, we'll take the red dot off. Okay. Since there aren't any other hands up, I'm going to go ahead and move on. What follows is from my book, The Life of Yeshua HaMashiach, An Hebraic Perspective, which is a commentary on the Gospels. I used the Thompson Chain Reference Bible's Harmony of the Gospels as an outline. Outline point number 37D is, the angel appears to Yosef. And this is in Matthew chapter 1, verse 20 and following. Okay. We already read the scripture, so I'm gonna just comment. Miriam returned from Elisheva's house and was found with child. She had some cockamamie excuse that the child is of Ruach HaKodesh of Elohim. But how many do you think believed her? I'll tell you how many. Not even Yosef, her betrothed husband, believed her. He was ready to quietly put her away until he was awakened from a sound sleep by someone he'd never seen before. Twice in Matthew chapter 1, verse 20 and 24, we are told that this is the angel of Yehovah. Now, I think this is not Gavriel, or he'd have been named. He was named in a couple of other places. In fact, he was named when Zechariah was praying at Shavuot the year before and was told that his wife would have a son, and his name became Yochanan HaMatbel, John the Immerser, or the Baptist. Okay, so Gabriel made that announcement. Gabriel made a lot of announcements. But this one, it says specifically, it's the angel of Yehovah, so I believe it was the angel of Yehovah. Now, I think, now this is not Gabriel, as I said before, what messes with our Greco-Roman minds is that the angel of Yehovah in the Tanakh, the one who spoke directly to men face to face, was, in my mind anyway, the risen Yeshua, the angel of Yehovah in Genesis 18, the angel that wrestled with Yaakov in Genesis 32, the one who spoke to Moshe in Exodus through Deuteronomy, the angel of Yehovah's host that spoke to Yehoshua in chapter 5 of his book, the angel that spoke to Manoah and his wife in Judges 13, were all Mashiach Yeshua, resurrected Mashiach Yeshua. In my mind. I could be wrong, but I doubt it. Matthew was written to Jews to prove that Yeshua was the Mashiach. The Jews would have known that Gabriel was a special messenger of Elohim to Israel. So why not mention his name if it is, in fact, Gabe? The angel being Gabe position is strengthened by the probability that Yosef was praying earnestly for what to do about Miriam. Anyway, this appearance is enough to convince Yosef to marry his wife post-haste, despite the ridicule to follow. Take that thinking for action. Obey Yehovah, no matter the cost to your reputation. They laughed at Noah until it started raining. Anyway, also, when we consider Hillel's second rule of interpretation, Gezerah Shavah, which Disciple Nazarene was just talking about, that like words, ideas, or phrases link different passages of Tanakh to each other. Two of those references I mentioned are linked and shed light on yet another passage. Now, this is another one, entirely different from the one that Disciple Nazarene came up with. Yaakov, wrestling with the angel of Yehovah, starts the weaving of his name together with Mashiach. In Genesis chapter 32, in verse 29, it says, "And Yaakov asked him and said, Tell me, I pray thee, thy name. And he said, Wherefore is it that thou dost ask after my name? And he blessed him there." This question is asked again in Judges 13, in verse 18. "And the angel of Yehovah said unto him, Why askest thou thus after my name, seeing it is secret?" The Hebrew word, why askest thou after my name, is the question. The Hebrew word translated secret in the King James is from the root, Hebrew 63:81, pala, which is rendered hidden in Stone's Tanakh, and can be rendered as wonderful. Okay? Because it's a wonder, see? The same root appears again in reference to a name in Isaiah chapter 9 and verses 6 and 7, where it says, "For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, the Mighty Elohim, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. Of the increase of government and peace, no end, upon the throne of David and upon his kingdom, to order it and to establish it with judgment and with justice from henceforth even forever. The zeal of Yehovah Tzevaot will perform this." So, in Genesis 32, the thread of the tapestry appears as, "Why do you ask after my name?" Reappears in Judges 13, "Why do you ask after my name, since my name is wonderful?" And then we see that wonderful name of Yehovah appears in reference to Mashiach, whose government and shalom will grow, le'olam ba'ed, world without end. Notice the salutation of the angel, "Yosef, thou son of David." How many sons of David were around right then? Unless Yosef's progenitors were still alive, none. This is a title unique to the royal line, and we see this royal blood in Matthew chapter 1 and verses 1 to 17. Although her other sons of David than Solomon existed, it was through Solomon that the royal line ran. Each chief heir of David was a unique son of David, the heir to the throne. This described Yosef, son of Yaakov, son of David. In Yirmiyahu chapter 22, verses 24 through 30, it is written, "As I live, saith Jehovah, though Kaniah, the son of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, were the signet upon my right hand, yet would I pluck thee thence. And I will give thee unto the hand of them that seek thy life, and into the hand of those of them whose face thou fearest, even unto the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and into the hand of the Chaldeans. And I will cast thee out, and thy mother that bare thee, into another country, where ye were not born, and there shall ye die. But to the land whereunto they desire to return, thither shall they not return. Is this man Coniah a despised broken idol? Is he a vessel wherein is no pleasure? Wherefore are they cast out, he and his seed, and are cast into the land which they know not? O earth, 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 hear the word of Jehovah. Thus saith Jehovah, write this man childless, a man that shall not prosper in his days, for no man of his seed shall prosper sitting upon the throne of David and ruling any more in Judah." That's pretty cut and dried, isn't it? This is a prophecy concerning the royal line of David. This Coniah is the same king as Jeconias in Matthew chapter 1 and verse 11. He is the last wicked king in a long line of wicked kings, punctuated every four or five generations by a good king in Yehuda. He was so wicked that Elohim removed the blessing of the kingdom from his line forever. But then, how could Yeshua prosperously reign on the throne of his father David? Good question. But if you look at Luke chapter 3, in verses 23 to 28, you can see Yeshua's got another genealogy. And it's a different genealogy. It's the same in the beginning, it's the same at the end, but in the middle, during the kingdom of David and Solomon and their offspring, it's different. I'm sorry, shortly after, between Yeshua and it's different. Let me show it to you, and I'll come back and point out the exact place where it's the same, in the place where it's different. Okay, and Yeshua himself began to be about 30 years of age, being, as was supposed, the son of Yosef, which was the son of Heli, which was the son of Matat, which was the son of Levi, which was the son of Melchi, which was the son of Yana, which was the son of Yosef, which was the son of Mattathias, which was the son of Amosh, which was the son of Naum, which was the son of Esli, which was the son of Nage, which was the son of Ma'at, which was the son of Mattathias, which was the son of Semaai, which was the son of Yosef, which was the son of Judah, which was the son of Joanna, interesting, which was the son of Resha, which was the son of Zerubbabel, which was the son of Shealtiel, which was the son of Neri, which was the son of Melchi, which was the son of Adi, which was the son of Kosam, which was the son of Elmadam, which was the son of which was the son of Yosi, which was the son of Eliezer, which was the son of Yorim, which was the son of Matat, which was the son of Levi, which was the son of Shimon, which was the son of Judah, which was the son of Yosef, which was the son of Yonan, which was the son of Eliakim, which was the son of Melaah, which was the son of Minan, which was the son of Mattathiah, which was the son of Nathan, which was the son of David, which was the son of Jesse, which was the son of Obed, which was the son of Boaz, which was the son of Salmon, was the son of Nashon, which was the son of Aminadav, which was the son of Aram, which was the son of Esrom, which was the son of Perez, which was the son of Yehuda, which was the son of Yaakov, son of Yitzhak, son of Abraham, son of Terah, son of Nahor, son of Saruch, son of Ragaal, which was the son of Phelech, which was the son of Heber, son of Salah, son of Canaan, son of Arphaxad, son of Shem, son of Noach, son of Lamech, son of Methuselah, son of Enoch, son of Yered, son of Malalael, son of Canaan, which was the son of Enosh, which was the son of Shet, which was the son of Adam, which was the son of Elohim. Here we have the genealogy of Yeshua through Miriam. Notice that in verse 31, let me read that again, which was the son of Meleah, which was the son of Minan, which was the son of Merathiah, which was the son of Nathan, which was the son of David. In verse 31, Miriam is in the line of David through Nathan, another son of David, not Solomon. Here's the answer to the riddle. Miriam was a blood descendant of David, which explains why she had to go to Bethlehem with Yosef to be taxed. She gave Yeshua the physical right to be called the son of David. The legal right to be called the son of David, as in the king, the rightful king, came through Yosef, the rightful biblical king of Israel, named the boy at the presentation and circumcision, and doing so, took him as his firstborn. Yosef's firstborn was physically not Yeshua, but he took him as his legal rightful heir. Okay? His principal heir and therefore the rightful king to the nation of Israel. Yeshua is not physically the son of Yosef, but he is legally and royally. He is not Jeconiah's seed. Yosef was precluded from the throne. Yeshua is not. Therefore, Yeshua has no crown prince. He was no crown prince. He was king from the moment of his circumcision and naming, since only he could be king. Ain't Elohim great? He put this curse on Coniah's line, but he made a workaround, and that workaround is in the line is at the point of Zerubbabel and Shealtiel, because from Coniah, in Coniah's line, is Zerubbabel and Shealtiel. There was a kinsman redeemer action going on there. Okay? There must have been a kinsman redeemer action happening here to keep the line of Nathan from being wiped out. Okay? If you look at Luke chapter 3 and verse 27, Matthew chapter 1 and verse 12, Ezra chapter 3 and verse 8, 1 Chronicles 3 and verse 19, and 2 Samuel 5:14, you can see how that all worked out. The kinsman redeemer begat children for his next kin, a brother or a cousin, to keep the line going and the property rights in the family. For as long as it took for the line to be renewed, that is how long the redeemer's line would be considered a part of the male-less line. In this case, it took two generations to beget a male to carry on the family property rights. It is a kinsman redeemer that Yeshua begets us to Elohim. Our next kin had to beget us into the line of Elohim so that we could partake of the blessings of his family. This could be done only by a sinless kinsman, Yeshua. It is important that Yosef not know Miriam until she bore her son and named him, so that the prophecy of Isaiah 7:14 could be fulfilled. The virgin had to be such right until the naming of the child, or the prophecy would be unfulfilled. And she would have to call his name Emmanuel. Okay? Elohim with us. Yehovah obeyed completely. He took Miriam to wife. He knew her not, and he named the child Yeshua, not Yosef. I think his next son was named Yosef. And you can see that in Matthew chapter 13 and verse 55, where Yeshua had a brother named Yosef. He also had a brother named Yaakov. Okay? Can't remember the other two right offhand. Anyway, that's all I got. Questions and comments? Disciple Nazarene, your hand is up. You may have the mic. By the way, in a kinsman-redeemer action, okay, the son that comes of the kinsman redeemer belongs to the line of the father who is being redeemed. Okay? So that would be Nathan's line was being redeemed. Okay? So they had no, this was not going to be a son of Zerubbabel or Shealtiel. It was going to be a son of Nathan. Okay? It was not going to be a son of David. They were just the closest relations that could do the kinsman redeemer action. And disciple Nazarene, you're up. Take them.
Shalom. Hopefully you can hear this. This is a mic test for the entire room. So the Gospel of Matthew drops a hint early on about the intent of the genealogy. If you notice, there's a reference here, son of David. So I'm just going to post one more verse. Bear with me. I'll try and find it. Okay. Okay. So that's significant. The gematria of the word David, the name David, is actually 14. And so what the author is doing is dividing the genealogy up into 14 to reflect the number of David's name. And then on top of that, you can see the division of 3. Well, 3 is like to be complete in gematria terms. So what you have the complete David. So they looked at the name, saw what it equates to numerically, and then divided the genealogy according to that number. And then what you have is a constructed genealogy that indicates that Yeshua is the complete David. He is the one that we are meant to be looking for when it comes to the son of David. So hopefully that makes sense. So with that, I'm off the mic. Shalom.
I'm back. Sorry, Dean, I wasn't able to. I needed to get away for just a second. But I got a feeling it was good. Lady of Wisdom, glad to see that you got somebody came to your aid. Let's see. Coco 759, welcome to Fulfilling Torah. We're here studying Yehovah's Word. And if anybody knows Coco, let us know so we can remove that red dot. We're having troubles with trolls who come in here just to destroy our peace, and so we leave the red dot on until we know who somebody is. Sorry about that, but it's how we got to do it. And Lady of Wisdom, your hand's up. Go ahead and take the mic.
Well, thank you. I don't know if you recognize my voice. I'm 66 for Fulfilling Torah, and I got better memory than you do. I do want to bring something up that was said in text a while ago. I think this person's left, but I'd like to say something about it. He said, when a woman's born under the law, she is pleasing to him. When you're obedient, you're not under the law. You're only under the law when you're disobedient. So I just wanted to bring that up. Thank you.
Absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. You're only under the law when you're disobedient. Very good. Other questions or comments? Truth and Ken, take the mic.
I just had one last small comment regarding the fact that Mary was Mary and Yah had enjoined without Yosef's knowledge. This is common, as a matter of fact, just like what we saw in our Torah portion today, in that the wife knew something that the husband did not. And what had to happen was that Yah had to speak to the husband. This is what normally happens. So often the wife can be in the know, can have certain wisdom, and the husband cannot. And often Yah has to set the husband straight. And here we have yet another example of Yosef having to be set straight, to be, you know, brought in the know. That's an interesting thing. I think that, you know, maybe he wasn't brought in the know beforehand, because this had to go through a normal marriage and birth, as in Mary had to be betrothed with a man before she could be with child. So that, you know, normalcy could take place. You know, I think it's important. I mean, we all know it's important for a woman to have a man to help her through that 9-month period anyway. It's good to see that, you know, that family ship and what's going on. And, of course, the father is always very helpful in ensuring that things are taken care of for the wife as she's growing and, you know, as her tummy is growing and such. But I just thought that was kind of neat that Yah did it this way. You know, that again, he did what he did. He literally visited her, as in, maybe he didn't number her, even though it's the same word, pakad. You might think he numbered her, because that's how we render it in, let's say, Shemot chapter 30, or was it 13, I'm sorry. Yeah, 13. Or no, actually maybe it was 30, I'm sorry. But sometimes it's rendered visited. And yeah, I think the Holy Ghost, through the Holy Ghost anyway, I believe Yah did pakad her. Just like he pakaded Sarah. And she then had a child. We actually saw it if we would have read 1 Samuel chapter 2, verse 21 through 28. Same thing, you know. Hannah was pakaded again. Yeah, I don't think it means numbered as it's rendered in some. Visited is sort of an interesting rendering. But there's some other good, very good words there for that, if you look at the concordances. You know, one being charged. I do like charged, so I really think that in, like, for example, in this case, Mary was charged with being the mother of the Messiah. You know, it was her duty. You know, so Yah had given her this duty that would be the visitation itself. Yeah. But anyway, that was only, what, a few verses in this portion. Sure does it seem like a, plus we had no psalm, sure does it seem like a short reading today. We didn't have a whole lot to go over, but every little bit counts to me. I'm loving every minute of it. So anyway, Shabbat Shalom to all. And enjoy the rest of the day, too, if I don't get a chance to say so. And I yield the mic.
Thanks, Ken. Appreciate that very much. Very good stuff. Now, Messianic Eagle, your hand is up. Go ahead, take the mic. Okay, don't take the mic. Go ahead, be that way. Did James and John, sons of thunder, know they were able to bring fire down from heaven like Eliah? Yeah, they probably did. Yeah, I mean, that would be a pretty silly thing to ask. Shall we bring down fire from heaven on these people? It's a pretty silly thing to ask if they knew they couldn't do it. But I can't really answer that. I don't know what was in their minds. I just know that that was a question that they asked, and Yeshua kind of rebuked them for it. I don't know. You don't know what you're about, man. Anyway, Messianic Eagle, do you still want the mic? I'm going to go ahead and give it to you again. Take it away.
Yeah, I apologize for that. I was right in the middle of trying to figure out who was sending me these ridiculous texts, and I wasn't looking up, and I thought the rule was that you took the mic before the next person or something. And I had my headphones off, Mark. Sorry about that. Now, I missed some of the conversation, so I might be a little offbeat here. But to me, following Torah in your heart, being circumcised in your heart, like Deuteronomy 10:16 and Deuteronomy 30 verse 6, is a lot of what it's about, in loving your neighbor and so on. Like in I think it's Leviticus 19:18, if I'm right. But here's the thing about this guy here. If anybody knows about him, I think he caused devastating effects. And the reason why I say that is because I don't even look at it as Old and New Testaments, or Tanakh and Brit Hadashah. I say that because, now, we don't know exactly when he was born. Between 155 to 160 A.D., born and died in Carthage, we have that info. Born or died in 200, but we don't have the exact date, I guess. At least not any that I've found. But he did the Old Testament, or that's what he named it, the Old Testament. In Latin, it's called, and he separated that by going the New Testament into, I have to really look at what I'm doing because I'm not fluent in Latin, by the way. Testament, no. Yeah, or testamentum, for crying out loud. And it just caused devastating effects, in my opinion. To me, it's all just, it's just part of God's word, okay? I mean, yeah, you have to, when people don't know that, you just say Old or New Testaments and stuff like that. You'd want to be pragmatic, take people for where they're for where they're at. But, that other comment that was made, too, when I was in between doing things, those of us who are in God's will, we really don't need the law. But let's just be honest. I mean, as chaotic as the world is, we do need rules. But the thing I point out to people, too, is, the 613 instructions didn't apply to everybody all the time anyway. Some laws were meant for women, some for men, some for children, some for boys, some for girls. Some were for the Levitical priests and their duties, and some specifically for Kohanim, or the sons chronologically under Aaron, directly. But if you want to get down to it, last I knew when I checked, there were 1,050 commandments in what we call the New Testament, Brit Hadashah. So I'm glad for the rules. I mean, it's bad enough already with them. God only knows what would be going on or what will go on when the tribulation comes. Then it's really going to be bad. But, you know, we need these rules. I serve, or at least I attempt to serve a God of order and instruction. God, you know, my God is methodical. He knows what he's doing. So, anyway, I don't feel I'm in bondage to any of this. I mean, you know, I'm a sinner, and I beg for his forgiveness. And Lord knows I made plenty of mistakes, and I'm sure I'll make some in the future. I mean, but, you know, again, I try to... I try to do this. Be therefore perfect as your heavenly, as your Father in heaven is perfect. You know, and I attempt, since I'm not saved by good works, hopefully I'm saved unto good works, and so on. Because my works are as filthy rags, which is Isaiah 64:6, I believe. And there is no good in me. But am I a long-winded preacher? I don't want to be a preacher, Lori. Trust me. I really don't. Oh, good. Okay. You make me feel bad, Lori. No, I'm just kidding. But, yeah, and, you know, there is no good in me. I already know this. You know, and I'm really paraphrasing here, but, you know, you got this too. So, to me, it's just all one book, scroll, if you will. I mean, whatever you want to call it, I guess. I thank God for his word. I thank God for his instruction. Yahshua is the word. So, it's about all I have. And Lady of Wisdom, or Mark, or whomever, you're up.
Thank you, Messianic Eagle. Appreciate your commentary today. It was very, very good. And Lady of Wisdom, you're up. Take it away.
Well, let me address the latter. I looked up that word perfect. It does not mean perfection. It means mature, moral and mental character. That helped me a lot. And when it comes to, you know, the terms Old Testament, New Testament, chapters and verses, man inserted that in there. I had the opportunity to read the scriptures without the chapters and the numbers. And let me tell you, it really makes a big difference.